Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. I apologize for the cramped quarters at the time we reserved this. This was the only room that was available. I know there are people in the in an overflow room also listening to this, so I apologize to you who are listening to my voice remotely. We do have a quorum. The first order of business is the minutes of the March 12th, 2019 meeting of the Government Operations Committee. May I have a motion to approve?
Move approval of the minutes from the...
Representative Nelson moves approval. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The minutes are approved. Representative Winkler, while you are approaching, I will move that House File 1500 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. I understand you also have an amendment. Would you like me to move that at this point?
Yes.
Okay. I will move the A9 amendment to put the bill in the shape Representative Winkler would like. Is there any discussion? Representative Baum?
Can the author step us through this?
Through the
amendment.
Sure.
The amendment, Representative Winkler.
Chair, Representative Quam, the first is page 3, line 23. We're inserting language that says the commission must establish a process to grant a waiver from the requirements. Currently, DPS has a waiver process in place. They've had one in place for a long period of time. And the situation in which this could be raised would be for individuals who are stateless, i.e. they cannot provide a form of documentation like a foreign birth certificate or a foreign passport because they don't have access to consular services because they're not officially part or a citizen of any state, and that's particularly true of refugees. So the Department of Public Safety does this already. This is to ensure that they continue to do it. It doesn't prescribe what kind of process needs to be used, but there will be one. And they then have to go through the process of finding other means of verifying identity than what is listed in the documents. If you go to page 4, lines 4 and 5, we are changing the requirement that applicant can avoid providing one of the primary documents by providing multiple secondary documents. We are clarifying that it has to be a primary and a secondary. So that is depending on your point of view, tighten up or make more difficult the process of establishing identity by having only primary and secondary options be available. And that is from our standpoint. Nobody moved. And those two provisions really do work together. Instead of having multiple secondary documents, if you don't have a primary document, we're following the waiver process that's in place. So those two things go together, and then you can see. On the amendment, section lines 1.10 and 1.11 are just clarifications of the provisions of the amendment. So that's what I'm asking for in the amendment, and I would ask the committee to accept it so that I can present the bill on that form.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the confusion was in the original language, there was allowing a combination of two secondary. In order to have, one secondary has a portion, one would have the other portion. So this is saying that whatever you supply must contain all the information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it's to clarify that you have to provide a document on a list of the primary documents that requirement must be met.
Okay. Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay. I will renew my motion to approve the A9 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill... No, the motion carries. The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like it, Representative Winkler. Would you like to describe your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Without belaboring it too long, this bill provides access to driver's license for Minnesotans who cannot demonstrate their legal status or lawful status under our immigration laws in Minnesota. Prior to 2003, it was not necessary to demonstrate this in order to get a driver's license. For the last 16 years, state regulations and now a state statute require people to demonstrate status in order to get a driver's license. The bill is supported by a very broad coalition of people, including the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, Hospitality Minnesota, the AgriGrove Council, as well as a number of labor unions, including SEIU and Unite Here, immigrant groups, ISAIAH, Jewish Community Action, a very broad array of groups. And I would like to just first point out that the people in this room have been at every single hearing. The overflow rooms have been used at every single hearing. This is an issue that is absolutely vital to the lives of thousands of Minnesotans. It is a bill that enhances public safety, it is good for business, and it reflects the reality that our immigration system has become a trap. It has become a dysfunctional system that only the bravest and boldest people would ever try to get through to become part of our country. And so as we realize that years and decades have passed and may pass before we have a functioning immigration system again in the nation, Minnesota has thousands of people living here, working, living, raising families, and we need to make sure that they have access to the basic ability to get a driver's license, get car insurance, drive their car, get families to and from school and activities and work without fear that they will be forced to drive illegally or unable to get to and from at all. So that is the goal of the bill. And Mr. Chair, there are, I think, a number of testifiers, and I would ask members.
Sure. Thank you for that testimony, Representative Winkler. Is the gentleman sitting next to you your first testifier?
Mr. Chair, it'd be surprising if he weren't.
So just to set some ground rules here, I'm going to ask testifiers to keep their remarks to 3 or 4 minutes. We still have we have other bills after this one. So I'll be trying to move through to keep us at a fairly quick pace here. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being heard. My name is Senior Commander John Lozoya. I'm with the St. Paul Police Community Engagement Unit. First I want to thank the chief author for Mr. Winkler and co-authors for their leadership on this bill. On behalf of the St. Paul Police Department, I'm here to testify in support of this important public safety bill. The mission of our St. Paul Police Department is to protect peace and maintain public safety through trusted service with respect. As a senior commander in my community, I play an important role in building relationships with our residents and create an environment of open communication. I have been a police officer, to include MP in the military, for over 40 years. In St. Paul, we are working close to create a city where everyone knows their voice is important and everyone has an opportunity to participate in shaping of the future of our career, of our community. We want our increasing diverse community, regardless of their legal status, their race, or national origin, to be safe in our community. We value our diversity and we celebrate our differences. Our police department supports access to driver's license for all Minnesotans because it makes our roads safe for everyone. First, drivers need to pass a written and driving test to obtain a license, ensuring all drivers are certified to drive. Second, the drivers are required to purchase auto insurance. Third, individuals with driver's license help law enforcement to verify identity. As a police officer, I must uphold the law and serve all members of our community. The best way to ensure the community is safe is to provide tools and access that people need to thrive, to have a good relationship in the community, and to ensure the community can trust law enforcement. Overall, giving driver's license to all drivers the opportunity to qualify for and obtain a driver's license helps law enforcement make our streets and our community safer. In my 40 years in law enforcement, I have learned that life happens in our communities. Our communities will drive, because they, out of necessity, they need to go to work. They need to go to school. They need to take kids to doctors. They need to go get food. Our commuters are going to drive anyway. So for our part is, why not have them driving, taking the proper tests, and being safe out on the street for everyone else? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your service, Commander Lavoie. We could not maybe have applause here. I think that would be consistent with the what we normally do with the House, so I appreciate that. I do actually have a list of people who have signed up to testify, so I think I'll go through that list in order and then see if there's anybody else who would like to testify. So next on the list, I have Marianne Peterson from J.M. Peterson Farms, Pine City. And after her will be Rabbi Emma Kipley-Ogman from Jewish Community Action. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Marianne Peterson. I am a co-owner of J.M. Peterson Farms from Pine City, Minnesota. I'm also on the board of directors from the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. And as members of the Minnesota Business Immigration Coalition, we have long supported driver's license for every Minnesotan. We support the House File 1500, first and foremost, for what it will do for safety and the opportunity for people to be able to get themselves to work. We have a population of people in Minnesota that are without citizenship documents and cannot get driver's license. These undocumented workers provide benefits to the state of Minnesota. As a dairy farmer, I can attest to you how beneficial they are. 12 other states provide license in similar fashions, including Utah. I hope, as a dairy farmer and individual in Minnesota that also is on the roads, that Minnesota can also become one of them. Dairy farms and many other rural and urban businesses employ people that do very hard work. They have skills that employers are looking for. Individuals come from many walks of life and have diverse backgrounds. Dairy farmers, like many others, need individuals to work for us. We require people to drive out to our farms in which to work. But, you know, as citizens, we are conscious of the fact that these individuals are, so they can drive safely, we care about our communities, our families, and we care about our employees. We'd like to keep the roads safe and also be able to provide people with access to jobs. We care, as I said, we care as employers for all the individuals that come to our places of employment, that they're able to come there safely. We can ask questions when we employ people about, we cannot ask questions about immigration status due to federal laws. We can work with federal immigration forms to get items changed. And we work with the Minnesota Business Immigration Coalition. However, House File 1500 would aid many Minnesota residents regardless of what happens at the federal level. This bill will restore what we presently had in 2002, and we keep rural roads, which that's what we deal with every day in the rural society, that is safer for our families and our communities and our employees. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Peterson. Next, I have Rabbi Emma Kipley-Ogman. After her will be Cassandra O'Hearn from the Department of Public Safety.
Good evening.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Emma Kipley-Ogman. I'm a resident of St. Paul and a rabbi. I work as a chaplain at McAllister College. I'm here tonight with Jewish Community Action, speaking in solidarity with immigrants' rights advocates, community-based groups and collectives, faith-based organizations, workers' rights advocates, and communities across the state working to pass this bill. In the United States, our most iconic symbol of freedom is a cracked copper bell, whose inscription reads, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all the inhabitants thereof." That biblical verse, Leviticus 25:10, reads in the ancient Hebrew, "Ukaratem deror ba'aretz lechol yoshveha." The word deror, liberty, is the same word as the name for a sparrow. a bird that can nest wherever it finds a home. Freedom of movement is inherently embedded in that ancient word "dror" that has become our core American notion of liberty. In a poignant conversation a decade ago, my grandparents reflected on a dear friend of theirs who was in early stages of dementia. They worried about his lapses of memory and what it would mean for his wife to care for him. But for them, the most powerful symbol of what that disease took from him was that his doctor said he had to stop driving. If anyone you love is 16 years old or 76, you know that in our time and place, a license to drive means independence, and driving is deeply enmeshed with our culture of liberated adulthood. Perhaps someday our public transit systems will be so effective that all of us will turn in our car keys. Until then, driving is an essential aspect of moving through this landscape we have designed for individual cars. It is essential to move between workplaces or to do the work of driving, to bring children to caregivers and caregivers to children, to bring food home, to participate in civic and communal life, to joyfully encounter the natural world that nourishes us. The freedom to drive is not an escape from responsibility. It is, in fact, the sort of liberty that requires great care and enables drivers to take responsibility for their work, for their loved ones, in fact, for all their lives, for all of our lives. While we do not and should not write American law from Torah, that ancient text offers us a values framework relevant to the legislation before this honored body that would expand access to the freedom to drive. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof. Honored representatives, you have a chance to do this tonight and as this bill moves forward. Unto all the inhabitants thereof means that our liberations are intertwined. Unto all the inhabitants thereof means that all of us share responsibility together for our path forward in this world. Unto all the inhabitants thereof means driver's licenses for all. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Rabbi Kipley Ogman. Cassandra O'Hearn, Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety, and after her will be Kathy Santa Maria Mendez. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. And I am here today to provide the Department of Public Safety's enthusiastic support for this bill. We appreciate the work that the author and committee members have done to develop a bill that is one that the department can stand behind, that the department can implement, and that provides for the public safety to ensure that drivers are able to get a driver's license, to go through that process of testing to ensure that they are safe upon the roads and that they are able to get insurance for their vehicles, something that individuals who do not have the ability to get a driver's license today are not able to do. There are a number of testifiers here today. So unless there are other questions, I just want to provide the Department of Public Safety support for this bill and leave it to others that would like to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn. I assume you will be sticking around in case there are questions.
I will be.
Okay, so we can always bring you back if we need to.
You may.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So next testifier on the list is Kathy Santa Maria Mendez. And after her will be Fernando Hernandez. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Santa Maria Mendez. I'm here before you as a cabinet member of the Young Women's Initiative of Minnesota. Launched by the Women's Foundation in partnership with the Governor's Office in 2016, the Young Women's Initiative of Minnesota is a multi-year, multi-million dollar investment that centers the leadership and solutions of young women of color, American Indian young women from Greater Minnesota, LGBTQ plus youth, and young women with disabilities. I would now like to share a little bit more about myself and let you know why this issue is very important to me. I am currently a senior at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, majoring in Chicano Latino Studies. I will be graduating in May and applying to law school in September. From that sentence, many people may say, wow, you really have yourself together. My life hasn't always been this way, however. My parents and I migrated from El Salvador 19 years ago. We flew in with a tourist visa and overstayed our visa. Thankfully, however, my parents entered just in time to benefit from temporary protected status, also known as TPS, which you may have seen in the news recently since the Trump administration has decided to terminate it for many countries. Thanks to this status, my parents were given a social security number and a work permit that allowed them to also obtain a driver's license. Fast forward a couple years later, my parents were denied their TPS renewal. We never knew exactly why this happened. This sent my family into complete panic because they became undocumented overnight. Due to this, my parents lost a privilege that many of us take for granted, having access to a driver's license. Now, during this time, I was still in middle school, so I didn't really understand what was going on. It wasn't until I entered high school and began thinking about college and everything else that I realized the implications of my undocumented status. I watched my parents and others around me struggle because of the lack of a driver's license. A simple task, such as going to the store for something, had to take a lot of thinking. Let's also remember that we're in Minnesota, where the weather isn't always the most adequate to simply walk or take public transportation. At this point, I wasn't old enough to drive yet, but I knew that when I became eligible to do so, I really wouldn't have that privilege. Fast forward, my parents and I are now permanent residents. We now get the privilege of driving without fear. I've seen both sides of the story, what it means to be undocumented and documented. I personally know the impact of both. Based on my knowledge and lived experiences, I ask that you please support this bill. As a member of the Young Women's Initiative of Minnesota, my job is to listen to my Latino community and take their voices into consideration when creating recommendations that those in power should take into consideration to help young women thrive. A driver's license isn't just about being able to drive. It's also about people being able to have a sense of identity. It's about people feeling safe whenever they need to show who they are. There are already many states that have approved a bill similar to House File 1500. This isn't a radical move. This is a humanitarian move. Although most people think of Latinos when this issue is brought up, let's not forget that this is a multi-ethnic, multi-racial issue. More specifically, black immigrants are the most impacted because they are the most vulnerable to being profiled and searched. I'm here before you in solidarity with my community and others. This isn't an issue about voting Republican or Democrat. This is an issue about voting for human dignity. Today, I hope you make the right vote. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Santa Maria Mendez. Fernando Hernandez, and after him will be Ifra Mansour. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Líder del Comité de Operaciones Gubernamentales y miembros de este comité, buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Fernando Fernández y resido en la ciudad de Brooklyn Park.
My name is Fernando Fernández and I reside in Brooklyn Park.
Soy padre de dos hijos ciudadanos de 11 y 15 años de edad.
My children are citizens, 11 and 15 years of age.
Tengo 14 años de ser miembro activo de la Iglesia Living Word Christian Center.
I've been an active member of the church
Living Word Christian Center.
Living Word Christian Center for 14 years.
Donde soy líder de Ujieres junto con mi esposa.
I'm one of the leaders helping in the church with my wife.
Mi hija de 14 años es miembro del grupo de sonido en la misma iglesia.
My daughter that is 14 is also a member of the team that helps with sound in the same church.
He venido hoy a decirles cuán necesaria es para mi familia la licencia de conducir.
I'm here today to tell you how important it is the driving licenses for my family.
Mi hijo de 11 años tiene un problema médico no totalmente diagnosticado.
My son, that is 11 years of age, has a medical condition that is not fully taken care of.
Actualmente estamos asistiendo a la Universidad de Minnesota para evaluaciones médicas.
We're going to the University of Minnesota for the medical evaluations.
Como líder de los sugieres en mi iglesia vamos a reuniones y servicios por lo menos dos veces a la semana.
As a leader of my church, I go to meetings at least once per week.
En los últimos años he sido detenido por la policía varias veces.
I've been detained in the last few years by the police a few times.
He recibido varios tickets, no por violaciones de tránsito vehicular.
I've received several tickets, not because I was doing something wrong,
sino por conducir sin licencia.
Just because I didn't have a driving license.
La última vez que fui detenido, el agente de tránsito que me detuvo.
Last time I was detained by one of the agents.
Si no tenía alguien quien viniera a recogerme, sería arrestado.
If I didn't have anybody to come pick me up, I would be arrested.
Por suerte tengo un amigo que es policía o fue policía retirado, a quien llamé y vino a recogerme.
I'm lucky that I have a retired police agent that is a friend of mine, and I called him to pick me up.
Mientras esperaba por mi amigo, decidí preguntarle a la gente de la policía por qué me había detenido.
While I was waiting for my friend to arrive, I decided to ask the agent why I was stopped.
Que si yo había cometido alguna infracción de tránsito.
If I had any wrongdoing while I was driving.
A lo que el agente contestó, cuando entré a tu placa me di cuenta que no tenías licencia.
He said that when he was checking the license plate, he realized he didn't have a driving license.
Cuando mi amigo me llevó a la casa, vio cómo mi hija salió a recibirme.
When my friend took me to my home, he saw how my daughters came out to receive me.
Me abrazó llorando.
And she hugged me crying.
Mi amigo se sintió consternado y dijo qué triste lo que están viviendo sus hijos.
My friend felt great sadness and he was upset by seeing what his friend was suffering.
Señores miembros de este comité, cada vez que salimos rumbo a la escuela,
members of this committee, every time we go to school,
a la iglesia o a las citas médicas de mi hijo,
to church or the medical appointments for my son,
salimos con angustia. Mis hijos están creciendo viendo a la policía no como una fuente de protección o servicios a los ciudadanos.
We feel great anguish, and my kids are growing up not seeing the police as some body that will help people,
sino como una organización a la que le temen,
but as an organization to be feared,
en la cual no confían,
and not to be trusted.
La edad promedio de la primera generación de hijos de migrantes latinos es de 32 años de edad.
The average age of the kids of immigrants, Latino immigrants, are in the 30s.
Estos jóvenes ciudadanos están creciendo temiendo a la policía.
These young people are growing up fearing the police.
Están sufriendo y creciendo con ansiedad y estrés.
They're growing up with a lot of anguish and stress.
El daño que se les está causando es terrible e innecesario.
The pain and suffering they're having is completely unnecessary.
Es por eso que hoy les pido que voten a favor de la propuesta de ley HF 1500.
So this is why I'm here to ask you that you vote in favor of this bill.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Dios los bendiga.
God bless you.
Gracias. Thank you for your testimony. Allowed a little extra time just to account for the translation for that testifier. Ifra Mansour is next on the list, followed by Vicente Peralta and Fernando Fernandez. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. My name is Ifra Mansour, and I'm an artist with the Black Immigrant Collective. I'm here to urge you to grant the freedom to drive to undocumented Minnesotans. I want to remind you of the many invisible origins of undocumented immigrants, including Latinx, Blacks, Afro-Latinos, and Caribbeans. Undocumented Minnesotans face higher discrimination from police as well as ICE. The Freedom to Drive Bill will allow undocumented people to access, to move around freely, to work, to go to school. This bill could provide data protection where the police is not allowed to share nation of origin or undocumented status with ICE. We want to encourage all Minnesotans to do right by their families, to keep everyone safe by having a driver's license. This is why former administrations granted driver's license access to undocumented immigrants. Granting driver's license to undocumented immigrants upholds our highest Minnesota standards of keeping our roads safe and allowing people, immigrants, to reach economic vitality. We all need cars to go to work, to take our kids to school, to daycare, and to go to places of worship. Minnesota has always been a welcoming place for immigrants. Let's extend this warm welcome to our fellow undocumented immigrants. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Vicente Peralta.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. My name is Vicente Peralta. I live in the city of Eden Prairie. I'm a father of two children, and their ages are 14 and 12. And I have worked in the insurance industry, and I'm also in the real estate industry. I worked for since 2007 for a large carrier as a sales person for a large carrier doing business in Minnesota. And as many here, I have lots to say, but I will try to keep it short. I think I'm in support of this bill because I think it's time for Minnesota to make a change. It will help Minnesota in so many different ways. You have heard some of the testimonies here. I think it's going to improve revenue from that perspective. But as far as from the insurance industry, I think it's a win-win situation because the fact that there's a large number of uninsured motorists out there, we're all sharing the risk when we are driving out there. The way the insurance company rate the risk is by verifying the driving record. If that driving record cannot be verifiable, there's a surcharge, therefore sometimes making insurance unaffordable for a lot of people. And ultimately, we're all affected by the high rates that insurance company will charge because of the we are all sharing the same risk. This is a bill that is not going to change the broken immigration system that we have at a federal level. This will not give legal status to anybody that holds a Minnesota, a valid Minnesota driver's license or give anybody that holds a valid Minnesota driver's license the right to vote. To the contrary, I think it's gonna enhance that. Currently in Minnesota, there's a lot of people that have permanent residence status and who hold a driver's license, and they don't have the right to vote, but there's no markings on the license saying otherwise. But I believe it's going to enhance in that regard. It will promote safer Minnesota roads because people will be able to go to driving school. They will understand the rules of the road. They will understand the laws of Minnesota. And ultimately, it's going to make the job of law enforcement a lot easier because they're going to be able to identify whoever is behind the wheel, and they will have proper identification and driving credentials. And I mentioned that my son is 14 years old. Pretty soon, he's going to be of driving age. And I think about safety. I think that I will feel a lot safer if I know that when he's driving out there, people that are behind the wheel are going to have proper driving credentials and driving education, and I think this is something our children deserve. For us to make this change for them, because they deserve safer roads in Minnesota, it's a win-win situation in many different ways. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. I have Fernando Fernandez. I have a Fernando Fernandez and a Fernando Hernandez. So maybe it might be a typo. That is the last person on the list. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Please identify yourself and
not making me write my speech and not be able to give it.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair and members of this committee, for allowing me to testify in strong support of House File 1500. My name is Amy Lang. I am a member of Isaiah and of Jewish Community Action. I'm part of a statewide faith-based network organizing, advocating, and standing in solidarity with immigrants in Minnesota. I'm the granddaughter of Jewish immigrants who came as young adults to this country under strict quotas because Jews were not wanted here. Speaking only Yiddish, they arrived escaping persecution and poverty. One came on false papers, and one lied about her age to qualify for entrance. I suppose some people on this committee might call them illegal, but I am here because my faith tells me that no human is illegal. My grandparents have a typical immigrant story. Though they had only a third grade education, they worked hard, started a business, and put their American-born children through college. My faith says to love the stranger as myself, to treat the stranger immigrant the same as I would the citizen. My Jewish people's history is a stark reminder of what happens when we don't heed this. I testify in support of driver's licenses because if we want families to be independent and self-supporting, with means to get to work and school and worship, this is the right thing to do. If we want immigrant parents to be present to raise their U.S. citizen children, we must pass this bill. In a state with brutal winters and inadequate public transportation, due in part to the legislature refusing to fund it, driving is a necessity. If we want our roads to be safe, our drivers qualified and insured, we must pass driver's licenses for all. I am one of 400 volunteer observers in immigration court on behalf of the Human Rights Defender Project. I've seen how a traffic stop for something as minor as failure to use a turn signal leads to deportation, because the lack of a license to prove identity leads to a trip to jail, a phone call to ICE, and lockup and ICE detention. When I watch little girls sob as their shackled daddies get led away, I am heartbroken and ashamed. This committee can't fix federal immigration policy, but by granting driver's licenses, we can show that Minnesota values our hardworking immigrant neighbors and recognizes every resident's basic human dignity. I urge you to vote yes on House File 1500.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lane. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Winkler. I ask that maybe if the chair can give me a little bit of leeway if this is outside the purview, but just a general question on page 12 on the bill, subdivision 11, national origin discrimination evidence. Representative Winkler, can you just kind of walk me through and the members of this committee what's that addressing? And especially the last couple words, they're evidence of national origin discrimination. I was just wondering if you could kind of walk me through a little bit more in depth on what that subdivision 11 is talking about.
Sure.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich. So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, one of the protected classes is national origin. And it protects individuals from being discriminated against based on their national origin. What this provision would do is create a standard that says that the mere fact that you have a non-compliant driver's license would be, and that you were denied some public service or some accommodation or some action was taken against you based solely on the fact that you have that driver's license would be enough to establish an initial claim under the Human Rights Act. It doesn't mean that you win. It merely says that you are establishing a claim for national origin discrimination by demonstrating that you were discriminated on that basis.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwan.
To that point, then if and if you show that and you were denied voting, you were denied because, which obviously you couldn't. So where do you have delineated where this does count and where it doesn't? Is it where by accepting you would be breaking a law, or maybe the author could clarify?
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kwan, and thank you for bringing up the issue of voting. I did not mention it earlier, but one of the testifiers did. So this license structure is, so we have a real ID, compliant driver's license in Minnesota. We have an enhanced driver's license, and then we have a non-compliant driver's license. That's under current law. What this bill does is purely for the non-compliant driver's license, you don't have to demonstrate your status in order to get the driver's license. So all Minnesota regular non-compliant driver's licenses would be the same, except that if in applying for that driver's license you do not show evidence of citizenship, then the back of that license will say not for voting. And election judges would be trained to look at the backside of the license to determine whether or not the license could be used as a basis for establishing eligibility to register and vote. So under existing law, and this certainly does nothing to change that, you have to be a citizen to vote. And it, by passing this bill, we would actually be enhancing the amount of drivers, the number of driver's licenses in Minnesota that would say not for voting, because the individual carrying it would not be a citizen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, then why didn't you include legible in that section where you say it should be marked?
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think that would be redundant. The Department of Public Safety issues driver's licenses and identification cards all the time, and we don't have any sections of them that are, you know, too small to read or, you know, written so that they're not clear. That's a standard administrative practice of the department.
Mr. Chair,
Quam.
I was just curious because in other parts of your bill, added language does utilize the word legible in different parts, and I thought that was sort of a common practice. I do have some clarifying questions.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, if adding the word legible to that provision would get your support for the bill, I'd be more than happy to do it.
Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair, possibly with a combination of other questions and queries, I just thought for consistency, since that verbiage was utilized in new language of which the author generated, I always just, it sort of stuck out at me, odd that it wasn't included in the other areas. In a couple spots you have sort of ignoring certain sections of current law, and I was wondering why, like 3.6 Minnesota Rules Part 7410.0410 or successor rules does not apply for. Can you enlighten us as to why that wouldn't apply?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I actually don't have off the top of my head what exactly that rule is. And I don't know if nonpartisan staff could help us or...
Representative Winkler, I see him, I see nonpartisan staff looking up the rules on a device, so maybe we should allow a time for that to happen, and Representative Quam can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are other questions, but I just assumed since you took the effort in order to note excluding something that the author would have understood that before taking the effort to do that. Now, it might be something associated with Real ID. I understand that. That's not being a part of the drafting of this. That's why I'm asking to be, you know, enlightened and educated on some of these things. But while that's being referenced...
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it might be helpful background to know that we have a combination of rulemaking and statute that... governs driver's licenses, and so the operation between those two is somewhat complex, and so I think nonpartisan staff can help, but the kind of the structure that I laid out for the types of licenses and how they're created is, you know, there's a series of technical changes that have to marry the existing regular, you know, rulemaking based driver's license provisions with statutory provisions.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Winkler. And that was part of the reason for that. I remember some of the intricacies of the Real ID bill discussion, and so that's why I was just wanting further clarification. Now, I notice in multiple places some of the documentation that can be utilized would be sourced from Department of Homeland Security, Social Security Administration. Now, they're federal agencies. But then I also noticed that you have where we aren't to share information on, and I was wondering if the somebody from DPS, I think, did testify earlier. I'd like to find out what things we currently share with other states and the federal government that's contained within the driver's license, because I'm pretty sure that I've heard of people being stopped in other states, or people in Minnesota being stopped, and they've got a driver's license from another state, and that there's some sort of a protocol of which data is shared. So I'm hoping the DPS person could help clarify what is currently shared, and then we can better understand your implications of saying that there wouldn't be anything that could possibly be shared in the, you know, of certain parts of the data.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think that's a good question for DPS, but to clarify, in this bill, we are only protecting information that relates to status, so that when people come in and they're applying for this kind of driver's license and they are using a non-U.S. birth certificate, for example, for their primary document, that information is kept private. And so other information related to criminal activity or other sorts of information, should that happen, that would be shared as usual. It's only the status aspect of this that it would be protected.
Representative Plums, then?
Well, no, actually, I'd like to, it'd be good for us to understand how extensive, you know, the data sharing is, plus with NAFTA, and I think if they, you know, pass, sign, and formalize the new agreement, there are provisions for if you've got a driver's license from another country, you're allowed transit, and they're allowed to have that acceptable here as part of the NAFTA language. And so there probably would be some interlocking with, you know, the feds that was required as part of that legislation. And I didn't know if possible that a DPS person also could maybe enlighten us on that.
I see Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn is here still. If you could please come back. Welcome back.
So thank you.
If you're able to respond to that.
I will do my best to do that. I also have a phone a friend if absolutely necessary. Again, my name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I think with respect to the information that is currently communicated with the federal government for a non-compliant driver's license, the only check that is done currently for non-compliant driver's license is if an individual has a Social Security number, that number is sent and matched with a name. But there is a current procedure on the application right now that if somebody does not have a Social Security number, they check a box and certify that they do not have a Social Security number, and then there is no federal check there. With respect to information that is shared with other states, there is a pointer system. This does not go through the federal government, but in order to ensure that somebody does not have a driver's license in more than one state at a time, there is a process where information, the name, I believe it's date of birth, maybe an address, is sent to the clearinghouse. And it's a pointer system that comes back with just information that says, yes, another state has a driver's license, maybe in Pennsylvania, pick a state, for illustrative purposes. But that's all the information that is returned. Or it comes back and says, nope, we do not have, this individual does not have a license in another state. So for non-compliant driver's licenses, my knowledge is that's the information that's shared. And if I may, I'm going to quickly turn to get a nod. Have I described it? In another state. So the one other check, there is called a problem driver check. I'm sure there's a more formal name than that. Also in this, if somebody has a problem, so they have a current driver's license, perhaps not current, it has been suspended in another state, but has not been, that process hasn't been resolved.
Right. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I,
sure.
I had mentioned that, plus I think staff was still diligently searching for that other information.
Sure. We do have a few other members on the list, Representative Quam, just so you're aware. Staff, I could ask staff to respond to that earlier question.
If they're ready, that would be good.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, so the rule that's being cited here is just it's an administrative rule that requires people applying for a driver's license or driving permit or state ID card to provide proof of residence, which would include potentially proof of citizenship. So effectively, this section is just it's superseding that rule by saying that if you're applying for a non-compliant driver's license, you don't need to comply with the requirements of the administrative rule related to citizenship.
Well, thank you.
Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair, I had suspicions that it was along those lines, but it's nice to actually have clarification on that. On the, was it page 12, I think, of where you had the nation of origin discrimination evidence, I was wondering, because one of the testifiers mentioned, you know, they're talking about employment, and my understanding is it's still illegal that, employers can have fines, possible other charges. So is this section that you have in your bill, you're having this prima facie evidence of discrimination, but if there's a, I'm going to be breaking this or I'm going to be breaking federal law, I always assumed federal law had precedence over, so this isn't actually requiring a person to break federal law and an employment law.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yes, this does not in any way change an employer's obligations with respect to status check and who they can hire and who they cannot hire. Think of this more like if you go to a hotel and check in and you have a non-compliant driver's license and they say, we don't want to rent to you. And then you could potentially have a discrimination claim based solely on the driver's license.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It'd be nice if it, specifically said this in no way is meant to influence a person to break federal law. I know what you might say, well, that's obvious, but, some person might not have that come to mind. I'm sort of wondering, because having been involved with, daycare, almost anything now, there are agreements for background checks. And when we run, in fact, you can't work at a daycare provider without having a background check with fingerprint, and it's run through the federal agencies to get that information. So if something's happening, are we in an issue of where if we can't share with any federal or state agencies, are we obstructing the possibility of a complete background check? Because we do have people that live in Minnesota but maybe work across state lines, and if they require a background check and it's the same as what Minnesota does, then part of that they would be taking their driver's license as part of the information to run the background check, but now we don't give that information, don't share, is there any compliance compatibility issue there?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, there's really no interaction there. All this bill does is say that the fact that you did not have to show status in order to get a driver's license is protected information. So I can't imagine a background check in which they would ask whether or not a person applied for a driver's license without demonstrating status. And this is the law in 12 states covering a quarter of the U.S. population. So this is not blazing new ground. 25% of Americans live in states where this is the law and would be subject to the same restrictions or data protection. So, and these are stronger maybe than in some places, but they still protect the idea or protect the applicant, because we don't want to have a situation in which people can apply for a driver's license but choose not to because they fear getting turned over to ICE for having done so. That's contrary to the purpose of the law.
Yeah. All right, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Leader Winkler, thank you very much for bringing this before this body, and I think there's really a strong argument on the public safety side of this, and I very much thank you for that. I think by having people go through class and driver's ed and those sort of things, obviously that would prove all of our driving, and maybe even some of us may be doing it again. No, it's. I think it's important, and having folks on the road that have insurance and that sort of thing. I think I've had people that I know that have been in accidents that have not been insured drivers, not necessarily immigrant drivers, but traditional domestic drivers that don't have insurance, and it's an absolute nightmare. So it's that's a common issue, and I'm glad you're dealing with that. I was reading some of our stuff, and it looks like New Mexico saw a drop in people without insurance, went down 24%. And a couple of years ago, I was involved with a committee, and we had all these meetings. And so every time you go buy or you get your new tabs, you have to say that you have insurance. And that was one of the things that we did, which is actually quite a little bit of a nightmare. But you know, to find the old insurance documents, bring them in, make sure you had everything right. But that was an effort to try to reduce people that were on the road that were uninsured. So, but more than that, I guess for me personally, my family personally and many people I know aren't that far off, or not here that long. I mean, I have relatives that, grandparents that were, spoke 100% Irish, Norwegian, and other languages, so it's really not that far back. I think there's a perception sometimes because we're, pretty white, I guess, that we've been here a long time and those sort of things, but my own family hasn't been here that long, and so I have a lot of empathy, and I think what I find is, as a body and as a legislator and those sort of things, that we can do a lot more or a lot better job of making people feel welcome in Minnesota and try to make our neighbors successful. And I think we do as a body, but this will go a long way in my mind. And I thank you for doing this, Leader Winkler, and then hearing this. But I'm actually glad we're doing this, and we can really help a lot of people. I just can't imagine the fear that some of our neighbors live in, and these stories. I heard the Transportation Committee, and it's just shocking the fear that they live in, because, and then I heard a story of a mother that wouldn't leave the house, or nobody could leave because she was just afraid to leave because she never wanted to be picked up or anything. So that's not, it's sad to me that our neighbors have to live with that. But anyways, that's, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Winkler, for bringing this for a good discussion tonight, and you drew quite a crowd. So
it's not me.
I just have some real basic questions that will probably be very easy for you to answer. So just to clarify in my mind, because I know you've gone through a lot of committees. I think is this your last committee?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Okay. Chair, Representative Lehman.
Okay, so, but it's my first time in hearing about this, so forgive me if you've repeated this answer many times before and I haven't heard it. So this is like the equivalent of a Class D driver's license, except it's non-compliant. So in some way it would look different from a Class D license.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, so this is a Class D driver's license or a non-compliant. Those are basically synonymous terms at this point in time. And so there would be two types of Class D licenses. One in which people demonstrated citizenship, in which case the not for voting language would not be on there because they're citizens and they're entitled to vote. And then there would be the other kind of license where it says in the back not for voting, And that would be regardless of your immigration status, as long as you don't prove citizenship or demonstrate citizenship, and the license in the back would say not for voting. So, you know, I have, you know, a regular driver's license. It's not real ID compliant, just like I've always had. This is that kind of driver's license. It's returning back to 2002 when you didn't have to show immigration status to get it.
Representative Lehman.
Okay, so the second half, Mr. Chair, the second half of my question is, and I'm going to just kind of list out some things. So there's all these other kinds of licenses. So there's real ID, there's enhanced. You can get a pilot's license, a bus driver, a commercial license. Does this apply to any of those, or is this is this bill just simply allowing that Class D non-compliant, has nothing to do with real ID enhanced, or any other kind of license?
Representative Lehman,
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, correct. It's only the Class D, no other kind of license.
Representative Lehman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Leader Winkler, for answering lots of questions about this. And just Representative Quam actually beat me to the punch on kind of a line of questioning that I had there. So thank you for that, Representative Quam. Off of Representative Lehman here, do Minnesota residents currently have to show ID to vote?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, they do not have to show an ID to vote, but it is one of the forms of identification that you can use in order to register and vote, and it's probably the most common.
Representative Heinrich.
Okay, thank you, Representative. That was my question, is what's the purpose, I guess, of having the language on the back of the ID when it's not required to show such a thing to vote?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, sorry to interrupt you, but it's to answer the concern that somehow creating this license now would create some sort of right to vote. I want to be very clear that that is not what this does and what it's not about.
Representative Heinrich.
Mr. Chair and Leader Winkler, I appreciate that. I was thinking that might be the case, in fact. Just to kind of ask a little bit of the same question Representative Quam did, but just to clarify, is it, in fact, in Minnesota state, and I don't know, maybe it's a question for research, you probably would know, Representative, but is it a Minnesota state statute that that an individual would have to have a federally issued Social Security number to, or that the employer needs to verify such a thing, or is that just federal law? Is there any, or what are the, and if so, what are the ramifications of a business that does not verify legal status, I guess? I don't know what the language is in federal law. Is that state law? Is it federal law? Maybe if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Representative Winkler, it's getting a little beyond this committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, it is primarily federal law. There may also be state law requirements, but, you know, the idea that you have to fill out, you know, your I-9 and you have to have, you know, do tax documents, all that starts primarily at the federal level, and so this would not in any way affect that.
Okay, one more, Mr. Chair, please. And thank you, Representative. You used the example of somebody walking into a hotel and possibly getting denied a stay at the hotel. I'd like to use maybe that same scenario with a little bit of a twist. Somebody walking into the hotel would like to get a job at the hotel. And I could see maybe a scenario where the person, you know, I've had my license photocopied both sides during that interview process. Could it possibly now, I guess for lack of a better term, tip off that owner that otherwise wouldn't have known what the legal status of an individual was, and now they have that knowledge because of the markings on the driver's license?
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, I think the answer is no, because the license, the only indicator would be that it says not for voting on the back, and that could that would include everyone, including permanent residents, who have every right to work, but, you know, the green card holders, if you will, they have every right to work, but they do not have a right to vote. And so this wouldn't change in any way whether or not they could be hired, and you couldn't be discriminated on the basis of that. And so just the idea alone would not be enough to trigger that kind of situation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Majority Leader Winkler, for bringing this bill forward, and to Representative Gomez, Representative Mariani, and Representative Hamilton for really pushing this forward too, and especially to our community members out there for your show of support for those in the hearing room today, and also for those in the overflow room too, and I think that for myself, coming from an immigrant community, I could relate to all of our neighbors who are here today pushing for this critical bill. And with some of the questions that were asked today, and Leader Winkler, I just want to say thank you for providing that protection in place for our neighbors who we have seen in other states who are discriminated against because of the language that they speak or because of their racial background. And I think that that's so crucial for what we're trying to do here for the public safety of all of the drivers that we have out there in the state of Minnesota. And so just want to say thank you again for bringing this forward, and to all of my co-authors out there, and for the members of the committee too, that I hope you all will support this. And this is really what we're seeing out here, democracy in action, where we have neighbors throughout the state of Minnesota who are coming in from all walks of life to support this, because we know that this bill will help provide the safety that we have on our roads, and also economically for the state, and how crucial immigrants are to our economy. And so I will urge members of the committee to join me in supporting this. And once again, Leader Winkler, just want to say thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And thank you to Representative Winkler for his leadership and for stepping up on this issue. You know, it's been 16 years that the community has been coming to the legislature and asking us to take this small step, not to change employment eligibility, change voting eligibility, fix our broken immigration system, but to provide a little bit of dignity, a little bit of safety as people are taking their kids to work, going to get groceries at the store, participating as members of our community in civic life and in our economy. And so I'm just really moved and thankful to be a co-author on this bill, and I want to thank all of the community members who are here tonight and who've been here for many years in a lot of cases. And Representative Clark is in the audience, and she was the author of this bill for many years. I think for all of the years that we've been talking about it, possibly. Yeah. So you know, it's really lovely to have her here on. I think this is our fifth committee stop, and it will be our last one before our conversation on the floor. And you know, I'm really thankful for Representative Hamilton and his leadership on this bill, and for my colleagues on the other side of the table for your questions tonight, and just for kind of like, you know, your openness is what I feel from you as far as, you know, kind of just trying to establish what are the parameters of this and what does it really mean. You know, and what it really means is providing tens of thousands of families who are living in our state with the ability to just drive safely. And for all of us, you know, Representative Cagle, I think it was in Judiciary, said transportation. Said something really, you know, she's like, I'm supporting this for a really selfish reason. Like, I have a 2-month-old, and when I'm driving her around, I want to make sure that the people who I'm passing in another car, like, know the rules of the road, have passed a driver's safety test, and have insurance should anything terrible happen. So yeah, I just want to express my gratitude to everyone who's here and everyone who's listening for all of your work and your many years of struggle. And we are hopeful that we're going to be able to, you know, provide this small piece of legislation that will enhance public safety, and will provide a little bit of peace of mind to some of our families. And I loved what one of our testifiers, Kathy Santa Maria Mendez, said. She said, this isn't a radical move. This is a humanitarian move. And so I thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Is there any additional member discussion? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm afraid that this offer is maybe a little bit late in coming, but I think it could still be workable. And that is, if members have any specific concerns or ways that they'd like to see the bill improved, I'm certainly open to doing that. It's heading to the general register, but if more committee work were needed at some point in the future to make some improvements and build support, I'd be more than open to doing that. And we've worked very diligently with a very broad coalition of people, some of whom are represented here, but not certainly all. And as the author of this bill, I feel like I am stepping into the shoes of a giant of the legislature on so many human rights and human dignity causes in Representative Karen Clark. And it's my great honor to carry a bill today that she, for so long, pushed forward with such courage and a great deal of empathy, compassion, and persistence. And so, Representative Clark, thank you for keeping this bill going for so long. And Representative Gomez, thank you for your comments and for your strong leadership and support. I want to thank Representative Hamilton for his leadership for a long time on this issue, the members of the committee for your willingness to be here and take the time tonight to go through this issue. The immigration system, I think there are some who think that the immigration system is an orderly process and there is a line and people get in line and they wait their turn and they get through, and that there are some people who are trying to get around it somehow, skip the line. In reality, our immigration system is a minefield, and it is filled with tripwires for people who are trying to simply live their lives and get through it to a place of opportunity and prosperity and security for for themselves and their families. In Minnesota, I think that we should be a place where we recognize that the arbitrary and capricious nature of the system should not permanently damage, harm, or scar the people who live in our state, contribute to our economy, and our friends and neighbors. And so I think from a technical standpoint and from a conceptual standpoint, this bill is very strong, and I haven't heard a great deal of opposition. What I'm hoping is that from a vision standpoint and a sense of opportunity in Minnesota to do the right thing, that we can get strong support for this bill tonight, and I hope on the floor as well. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your time and would ask for the members to vote for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1500 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. People are certainly welcome to stay for the rest of our agenda for this evening. I just have this feeling I might want to wait about.
It's going to be exciting.
I'm not going to formally recess because I might lose everybody for the night. So, I think I want to give people a chance to get out. Members, just so you are aware, there are some snacks outside that the speaker has graciously provided. I would ask that if you do take them, members only go one at a time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Quam.
Could the author of the next bill we're going to hear approach the...
Yep. I see her. She's kind of hemmed in at the moment, though. So why don't we give her a minute and give the people an opportunity just to step out.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Yeah. He did make you. It's okay. Everyone's just paid, right?
No.
Okay, I'll describe it. I'll get there. Welcome to the committee, Representative Sinesh Pudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And they just went to get my testifiers.
Okay.
I didn't think to call them in.
Sure. Would you like to proceed at this point?
Sure. We'll get started so okay. That we can get
sure.
Folks out of here
so
today.
I will move that House File 1381 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Would you like to describe your bill?
Yes, thank you very much. This is House File 1381. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This establishes a program, and it established duties for the Commissioner of Health, creates a Community Solutions Advisory Council, specifies organizations eligible for grants, requires the Commissioner to develop a request for proposals for grants, and requires those grants to be prioritized and awarded to organizations and entities in counties with higher proportions of people of color and American Indian, and requires a grant the grant recipients to report those outcomes to the commissioner. The idea of this grant, this Community Solutions Grant Program, came from a series of listening sessions that's been over 5 years in the making. So there's been a lot of work, there's been a lot of discussion around it, and I am very, very proud to carry this for the Children's Defense Fund as they've been working so hard. They kept hearing over and over again that the communities had the ideas and the solutions, but often did not have the resources to carry those out. As we all know, Minnesota has some of the worst disparities tied to child well-being for children of color and American Indian children, such as health, education, infant mortality, and those are the sort of indicators that we are concerned about. These disparities exist because our public policies don't leverage the existing strength of our communities. The Community Solutions Fund grant program is a strategy by which we can begin to address the disparities in resources to specific communities. It leverages the assets to the communities to address their problems, and it brings those who are most impacted into the decision-making process. So some of the specifics for this bill are that grants are awarded to organizations that focus on improving healthy child development outcomes for communities of color. The Community Solutions Grant Program represents more than just money, and it's important to know that because it also is recognition of our communities of color, our American Indian communities, and the geographically dispersed communities that have that invaluable knowledge and that needs to be active and valued participants within the creation of the solutions for themselves. I'd like to ask you, and I strongly encourage all of you, to support House File 1381. Children of color and American Indian children are the future of our state. The collective health and collective prosperity of our state is ultimately tied to these children, and these children of colors and American Indian children are thriving in Minnesota, and we ask for your support.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and I have one testifier on the list. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure, thank you. Hello, Chair Freiberg and members of the committee. My name is Barty Wahi, and I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota and a member of the Voices and Choices for Children Steering Committee. Voices and Choices is a coalition that is focused on improving the outcomes for children of color and American Indian children 0 to 8. We are focused on the implementation of policies and practices that meaningfully address the disparities that exist in the state of Minnesota. We support House File 1381, and particularly the process outlined within it to appoint a Community Solutions Advisory Council. The proposed council ensures that affected communities are a part of the decision-making process for this program and represent a critical strategy in ensuring more equitable programs and policies. Our disparities in the state of Minnesota have existed for many years, and we believe that it takes alternative processes and strategies in order to ensure that those disparities begin to shrink. The Community Solutions Grant Program is addressing the unique intersection of child development outcomes and health equity, and therefore it requires an advisory group that is intentionally looking at that intersection. The bill, it represents more than an appropriation, as Representative stated. It also is an example of how state government can engage in a more representative process, particularly one that leverages the assets of communities as opposed to assuming they have none. And it ensures that that communities of color and American Indian communities are able to really leverage their own strengths and their own innovative solutions to address the needs to improve outcomes for their children.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Wahi. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1381? Seeing none, any member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Kunesh-Podein?
Oh, thank you for taking this into consideration. We are really excited about this process, this grant, and I know that the folks that have worked on this very long and very diligently would appreciate your support, and so at this time I would ask members and the chair to move this on its path to success.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1381 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Fisher of House File 1287. While you're coming up, I will move that House File 1287 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. One moment.
Sure.
Apparently there's some uncertainty about whether I said Ways and Means on House File 1381, Representative Kunesh Padin's bill. I did? Okay, I thought I did. So, okay. I can remake the motion if anyone's uncertain, but apparently I'm being told I did. Yeah, okay, yes, okay. All right, I apologize. Representative Fisher, so I will, if I haven't already, I will move that House File 1287 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. If you could please present your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I can definitely do that. First of all, I want to apologize because I thought I'd sent out some information on an amendment that would impact the presentation because it has to do with the group that would do a report back, and I did bring the information. I know you cannot accept the amendment, but I did want to make sure the committee had the information, and I apologize for the...
Okay. Well, I guess, yeah, if you... Yeah. Do we have a page? Oh, okay. Oh, sure. Sorry. Yeah. You can just give it to him. He can make sure members have it.
So, first of all, I'll talk to the bill. Thank you for the opportunity. And I also want to thank Representative Hamilton and Zerwas, who have helped work on this bill over the past couple of years. This is a bill that came to our attention a few years ago with some people who are disabled, who are parents. There's a number of times where there are challenges when you're doing parenting of and you've got kids and you're disabled that sometimes some of the people that are working with you aren't able to provide the services out there that are needed to make sure that it's very successful. And so what this bill does is it establishes the Parenting with a Disability Support Services pilot project and requires the Commissioner of Human Services to seek all necessary federal waivers and amendments to the medical estate plan and approval from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to expand to the Parenting with a Disability Support Services project. And basically what it does is it sets up a process where besides you having normal supports that you would have for living, it would provide additional supports that would make parenting happen in a much easier way. Sometimes when those supports aren't available, sometimes people in child protection will come along and say, oh, you're not doing it properly, and then they start taking children out in a much higher percentage than they do in the regular population. And what I'd like to do at this point in time, what it does is it also sets up a report that would come back in and some evaluation to see how effective this program is for the future. And I do have some testifiers here. If you'd like, I could turn it over to them at this point in time.
Sure, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Chair. Good evening, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Nikki Villavicencio, and I'm here with my partner Daryl Paulson and my daughter Allie Paulson, and we're here to discuss House File 1287. As a lifelong disability advocate, I have fought for access to health care, public transit, and all aspects of community integration. It wasn't until I became a mother that I realized that parents with disabilities were living in the shadows of the community. According to the MnLINC data, parents with a disability label in their school records are more than three times more likely to have their parental rights terminated than parents without a disability label. As for the child welfare involvement, parents with a disability label are more than twice as likely to have CPS in their life than parents without a disability label. House File 1287 is a common sense approach to prevent parents with disabilities from having to break up as a family and or lead to child welfare action. This bill will create a pilot project, and it would allow for home care workers to assist with child rearing tasks, establish an advisory committee, appropriate funding, and require a report. Minnesota historically has been a leader in disability services, as you guys probably know. Consequently, though, let us begin to prioritize families of all types. House File 1287 will be the first bill in the country to tackle this issue from a proactive perspective. This bill would start to restore dignity by leaving the responsibility for child rearing and decision making in the hands of the parents. This bill promotes the recognition of parents with disabilities, their parenting capabilities with or without supports. And most importantly, this bill would reduce the fear of having a child removed solely based on the presence of a disability. Thank you for hearing this, and if there's any questions, I'm open to them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Villavicencio. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1287? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Okay. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Fisher for bringing this bill forward. This is a pretty big undertaking in looking at how PCAs are allotted and the work that it takes for individuals to raise a family in challenging circumstances. Especially when you're reliant upon PCA services that I think in all the ways that we do the right thing in Minnesota to provide services, there's still instances where there's gaps. And I think the testifiers today and the advocates for this bill over the last several years have identified some of these gaps. And so I support this bill and I'm glad that it's moving through.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Is there, have a couple over here. I just wanted to mention, too, about this amendment that you handed out. Like, I don't think we can accept it at this point.
No, I understand.
Well, Representative Zerwas?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair.
This is the same amendment we talked about a couple years ago when we started in your office.
I was going to say I don't see any objection to it. You do have another committee stop. I mean, unless a member here raises a...
Mr. Chair, I think we just put it on. I don't have a concern with it. Unless someone else objects, I certainly don't in this instance.
I am concerned about a potential precedent here, so...
I would never hold you to that.
I will hold you to never holding me to that. I will accept that, Representative.
He might go.
Representative Kwong, how about we go to the other people who signed, who had their hands up first, or would you? Well, they're saying they'd like to address this issue. Representative Kwong, did you have concerns with the amendment or anything?
Only that I do have a memory.
I know who I will blame if this precedent gets used against me in some manner in the future, Representative Fisher.
This would be added on to the next stop, but because it was changing the committee makeup a little bit, I wanted the committee to be aware of that.
Yes.
So I'm not asking that it be added on, but I wanted to make sure everybody was aware of it, because a chunk of it was just technical stuff that was going in.
Yes. I did notice that it was changing the committee makeup, which is definitely within the jurisdictions of the Government Operations Committee. So I did want to at least have committee members saying on the record if they had any concerns about it. So my thinking was when you went to the Ways and Means Committee, you could offer the amendment there. But you're actually being encouraged by several members here to offer it. So I see lots of eager looks here. I will move the A19-0141 amendment. So is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. The bill is in the shape you would like it. A great violation to our rules. Yes, Representative Zerwas?
Mr. Chair, I'm thrilled that you're showing this willingness to bend the, the committee's rules. And, Mr. Chair, I have a host of amendments for the two Lesh bills coming up. Really appreciate this new spirit.
Okay, I'll be sure Representative Lesh knows to be in touch with Representative Fisher when that occurs. I totally lost my train of thought. Somebody was on the list. Whoever it is, want to talk? Just kidding. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher. I just want to say thank you, Nikki and Daryl and Allie, for being here today. I know that you have been very passionate advocates in this space, and I know we've had a number of conversations about this, and I have to say, you know, being a parent is really tough. It's always tough. But when you have other challenges that you face on top of that, that make it even that much more challenging, I really applaud you for all that work to raise a healthy, happy little one who is in good spirits here today. So I just wanted to say I fully support this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Elkins?
Pretty much the same thing, Daryl. Thank you. You guys are an inspiration to all of us. I don't think I've ever met Allie before, so thank you for bringing it.
Questions for her. She's good at talking.
She's on spring break, so this is her third time at the Capitol this week.
Are there any additional member questions? Okay, any closing remarks, Representative Fisher? You probably want to move the microphone back.
Oh, sorry.
I just want to say thank you to the committee. I appreciate the latitude on the amendment to adopt that, and I think this is something that's going to be really great to help forge ahead for a program that could not only serve our disabled parents here, but also as a model throughout the country. Thank you, and I ask for your continued support.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1287, as reluctantly amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way, Representative Fisher.
Thank you.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Representative Mason, I understand you have a testifier who has a time-sensitive issue. So I will move, this is House File 2318, I will move that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee. I guess you were already here. Representative Mason,
thank
if you could please present your bill.
Okay, thank you very much. I do have an amendment that is being passed out. It's DE1. If we could pass that first, I'd appreciate that. It adds a couple of dates to the that weren't in the original bill.
Just had
It also adds the.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see.
2.3.
Oh. Okay, can you explain? Once again, there's a slight amendment issue potentially. Mr. Gehring, could you maybe explain to the committee what's going on here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, so from what I understand, this amendment was adopted in the Senate. It will be. Okay. So this language conforms to an amendment that will be offered in the Senate. One of the substantive differences here is that it adds some appointment date requirements. So on line 2.6, it requires appointments to the task force to be made by July 1st, 2019. It requires a report on 2.26 to be made by January 31st, 2020. And I think beyond that, I'll defer to Representative Mason to explain the amendment.
Okay, and item 2.29 is added there as well. Regarding the open meeting.
Okay, and this amendment also did not meet the deadline. I have been sort of under the impression it just added a couple dates. It's a delete all amendment, and it does have that provision about the open meeting law. I think I sort of feel like I do need to probably draw the line somewhere as far as amendments.
Okay.
Okay. So, but this is.
It's got one more committee to go.
It does have a delete all amendment. This is just modifying a few things from the delete all amendment. So the delete all amendment, the original one, was given to the committee on time.
Wait, there's an amendment besides the DE one?
Okay. Is that in our packets?
No.
Okay. Okay, how about, Representative Mason, how about you describe the bill at this point? We'll see if we can figure out what's going on with the amendments.
There is a concern about how divorce affects the well-being of children. And a large number of studies have shown that children with gone through divorce and versus children who parents who have been continuously married have poorer outcomes on the average than do the children that with continuously married parents. Some of the things, they will exhibit more conduct problems, have more emotional problems, anxiety, obtain lower academic test scores in school, and have problems with social relationships. Their parents also have feelings of depression, loneliness, regret, etc. And I know since I've been in the legislature, some of the people that have come to me with problems involving divorce have been huge. I mean, I know it affects our communities greatly. So at any rate, in general, studies have found that children's adjustment to divorce is directly related to how the parents respond and react to divorce. So House File 2318 is a bill to establish a family law mediation task force to advise them and inform the legislature on the impact of conflict during the marital dissolution process and work to develop a process to reduce the conflict of divorce through the implementation of conflict resolution procedures. And the commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services shall provide the support, staff and office space and administrative services for this task force. The best way to help divorcing parents is to provide a cooperative resolution process at the time of the divorce. And I have a testifier here who will give you some additional information. In the bill, you will see the number of, there is background on the membership for the task force.
Thank you. Before we proceed, I think that there is actually an amendment that's marked A19-0160 that was received in time. That's posted to the committee website. It does not appear to be in members' packets. And the DE amendment that we have in front of us does just add those dates as well as the provision about the open meeting law. So I may hold off on taking action at this point, at least until the page is going to get the other amendment I mentioned. But that one was received in time and is posted on the committee website. So But I know you have a time. I know you have some time considerations.
So the same bill is being heard.
Yep. So if you could proceed with your testimony. Yep. Please use the microphone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And committee members, my name is Diane Anderson, and I'm actually a former state representative, and I've worked on several family law reform issues throughout the last 28 years. There's a lot of research out there regarding the effect of divorce on children. The adversarial court process often causes a negative impact upon children and families, and we should find ways to move away from this adversarial court process. The non-adversarial process methods can help to reduce the hostilities that often accompanies people who are going through a dissolution. These non-adversarial processes can also help parents minimize the conflict they have with each other, which will help to minimize negative consequences for their children. And more non-adversarial processes can also improve voluntary compliance with parenting issues that the parties may have. So this idea of a task force is a way that we can be a very effective way to bring people together to talk about these issues, get information from professional people who understand the issues that people experience when they're going through a dissolution, and this is a way we can come up with some ideas and solutions that we could use here in Minnesota. So we need a better divorce process that will teach people how to reduce the conflict between the parents and help them to better parent their children, give parents tools to use, such as how to deal with the other parent, and give parents information about how the divorce process works. So really the goal is to have healthier children and families and to have the parents to have a better parent-child relationship. So in 2017, there were 7,477 divorce cases involving children, and in 2018, there were 7,444 cases. So we really have a duty to help the parents of these children that are affected by divorce to better equip them and their families to have their lives after the divorce. So I really appreciate your consideration for this bill.
Can I add, you should have a letter from Ron Elwell of Legal Aid in your packet as well, who supports the bill and had testified in a previous committee.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2318? Is there any member discussion? Representative Selk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to throw a real wrench into it, but it's a point of, in my mind, I'm going to make up a term here. It's not advised, but I can't think of any other way to say it. I think it has to be agreed that there's a strong, if not significant, amount of family dysfunction that happens long before divorce is considered. And oftentimes that brings great weight to the issue of personality development, relation development, and all of those elements that then are falling apart. So I just would like to be cautious about what is identified and who, the timing to me is everything. And we are in this law, I think, coming very late to the game with what may be very good solution and very helpful things for the process of divorce, but the actual impacting of children, I think we would need to be in the game much earlier than what this will allow. That doesn't, in my mind, doesn't speak at all against the amendment and or the process that would be a result of the amendment, but I would like to see if there's effort in this regard that's significant, is to offer families solutions as they find themselves entering into relationship dysfunction rather than only coming with a Band-Aid after the horse is out of the barn, if you will, or the relationship is starting to fall apart. So I'm more or less offering my perspective. I would like, as this is marketed and or put forward, that we just be very cautious as to how the wording relates to the timing of a relationship process. So I know you can use that for whatever you want. You don't even have to respond. I'm just offering that I think there's room here to be careful about how this is put forward to the public. Thank you.
Comments, Representative Mason?
Item one, I hear what you're saying, and I understand the point. that's, I'm thinking, that's another bill. And there was an interesting comment about custody on NPR over the weekend. And, I mean, there's, to me it sounds really awful where they actually send the child, and this, again, having parents that are, have so much animosity towards them, and the deal is, what they were talking about is where one parent is accused of brainwashing the child, so they will send the child and the, supposedly the parent that of the parent that the, with the parent that the child doesn't like to basically a ranch in California is what it sounds like. And but again, at the end, there are kids that were went through this process that they just, it was just awful. I mean, the kids were not part of the family. So there's some, there may be a lot of experimenting going on. Some of it is healthy, some of it is not. But this deals with where they are already at the dissolution process. And that, you know, and I'm thinking, as I said, we'll do another bill for what you're trying to do. But I will let Ms. Anderson speak to that.
Ms. Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Sox. This has been, this is a hard issue to deal with. We've been trying to come up with solutions for a long time, and so we can keep that in mind when we're doing deliberations on the task force to bring that up to people. But it is going to be more ways that you can go through the court process, your dissolution process better will be the focus.
All right. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, we still have the issue of the amendments to deal with, and I think I figured out what's going on. We have a slightly unusual situation here. We have the amendment marked A19-0160, which a member should have now in front of them. That does have the wrong bill number on it, but that one did meet deadline. so we, but my understanding is you're interested, if it's amenable to members of the committee, you would be interested in having the DE1 amendment adopted instead?
Exactly. That's the one that we just handed out tonight.
Yes.
First.
So the only changes between that and the one that did meet deadline, the 0160, is are the two dates on line 2.6 and 2.26, as well as the statement that they're subject to the open meeting law.
Can I make a clarification? House file 1744 was my original bill. But in order to get to all the committees before Friday, this is a clone. The other bill is in judiciary or civil law at this point.
That's right. Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair, there on 2.9 and 2.10, there are slight differences in the members' task force, but no substantive delta. So it's just slight language changes. And then in the report, Subdivision 6, there are, some more extensive changes than just the date.
Are you?
But it's not as substantive. I'm looking at the two different ones, holding them.
Oh, okay.
And doing a verification. In other words, I'm saying that there are slightly more than the chair had noted. However, for the most part, not substantive, other than the possibility of a little more detail in the report, which I guess I don't see as being a whole lot of issue-wise.
Okay, if Representative Quam, if you have any concerns, we do not need to, we can adopt the A160 amendment, although on that one we would need to correct the bill number.
Well, I think if you wanted to avoid the precedence of accepting a delete all that didn't meet deadline, you could do a technical amendment and correction to the one that did meet.
Okay.
Because you'd have to do it anyway for the bill number, and you would then make the date changes that are usually considered technical. And then the verbiage changes, if it's clarifying, I think I've heard that as being accepted as technical, but I will remember the extent to which
I think I think Representative Quam, I think I'm just going to move the A19-0160 amendment, the one that did meet deadline, but correct, since the bill number is a technical change, change that to from 1744 to 2318. So any discussion to that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Can we do the technical correction of dates on that?
I think we're getting bogged down here, so I'm going to move the amendment that did meet deadline, the A19-0160 amendment, with the technical correction of the bill number on line 1.1. So any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Where is this?
Going to Ways and Means, so there will be an opportunity to make...
After Ways and Means, which committee is it going to go down to?
Mr.
Chairman, so the Judiciary Civil Law Committee.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, so they could make the corrections.
Correct. Okay, so all in favor of the A19-0160 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is almost in the shape you would like it, Representative Mason. Is there any additional member discussion? Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, the bill in its current form, I do have concerns about the open meeting.
Okay.
Which I don't think was included in the amendment we added. And so if they add it at a following committee, then, you know, it's our purview if we were going to fix that oversight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
The open meeting law, wouldn't that be for judiciary, wouldn't that be appropriate to put on there also? And or, I guess Mr. Gary is putting his...
My understanding is that is correct, Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, so we could take... Representative Mason could take care of it there.
Correct.
And or if they're trying to match it up with the Senate... If it's not the same, it would go to a conference committee. They could fix it there also.
Correct.
Okay. This amendment was provided by Senate counsel, so it will be going on. And the Senate is hearing this bill tonight as well.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Mason?
I think most of us are aware that there are a number of our families that are having a lot of problems. Hopefully this will help those families at least a little bit resolve some of the animosity and contentiousness. So I truly ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Mason. I will renew my motion that House File 2318 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. House File 142, Representative Lesh. I will move that House File 142 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I go ahead?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, House File 142 is one of those bills that I like carrying more than almost all other bills in my term in the legislature, because it's taking care of someone who the system failed. Ayodele Famodu, and I think that's the first time I did not butcher her name, is a resident of Ramsey County and also an employee of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Due to her position, she is one of the few public employees who suffer the unfortunate situation of deploying in service of her country and losing money. So this bill offers differential pay for county employees like her who deploy but actually have to serve their country and lose money. She's in the position where she could lose her house. She's trying to refinance her house. So she deployed in September in the service of Operation Spartan Shield in Kuwait. She is an 04, now made major on deployment, and is a JAG officer. She had practiced law for approximately 8 to 9 years prior to enlisting to serve her country, was commissioned an officer, and performs admirably in the service of the Red Bulls 34th Infantry Division. It's been almost a year now that I've attempted to work with Ramsey County to have them fix the situation for her so she does not lose her home. She's the primary breadwinner for her family. Most of the local units of government of which I am aware offer differential pay so that service members do not suffer when serving their country on deployment or when they're mobilized. Ramsey County does not. They have politely declined to address this, and I thought I had given them enough time, almost a year, to work on it, and when they politely declined again, I said, well, it's time to bring a bill to serve some level of justice for service members like Major Ayodele Famodu, so that she is not harmed when she's deployed. I will add this one last thing, Mr. Chair, and I think members have a copy of her statement in the packets, is that right? So I won't reread this, but when I had a command, one of the major issues was soldiers being distracted from the mission. It doesn't matter what that mission is. The mission could be an actual fire mission. It could be a mission to serve personnel. It could be a mission to cook in the chow hall. Everyone has a specific mission. As a commander, you need your soldiers to be focused on the mission. When they have issues back at home, whether it's family issues, social issues, or financial issues, they cannot focus on the mission. So this is an important piece to make sure that our service members can focus on the mission when they're mobilized as well. I ask for your support and stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Lesh. And I understand Major Famodu had testified by phone in other committees and was interested in doing it here but was unable to make it work.
That's right. Mr. Chair and members, she's testified a couple times now. I've talked to her. Kuwait is 9 hours ahead. So I don't even know what time it is right now or even what day it is, actually. But it would be, you know, 0:30 for her over in Kuwait. And it's got – so she offered the testimony. Sure.
Thank you.
Testimony to move that.
Is there anybody who would like to testify on House File 142? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, speak into the microphone, and proceed with your testimony.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Matt Hilgart. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all 87 counties. I would wager that no one in this room would argue that a service member should be at risk of losing their home while serving their country. And I'd like to be very clear today that our concerns are not on the intent of this bill, but the effects of the employer that, in the case described by Representative Lesh, is already paying the higher of the two benefit structures. As the letter in front of you states, and I just want to make sure that there is a letter, otherwise I do have copies of that.
How about our page? Grab that and hand it out, just in case.
As the letter in front of you states, counties are proud to offer an array of employment benefits that are strictly catered to veterans. Specifically, counties provide preference points in hiring, protections from undue termination, of which I think we're very proud to say that AMC worked with some members on this committee just 2 years ago, but with House and Senate members in a bipartisan fashion to pass the first updates to veterans' preference termination proceedings that the state has seen in the last two decades. Leave protections, accrual of benefit and wages, and compensation for 15 days paid leave. I want to thank Representative Lesh for meeting with AMC to hear our perspective and would offer the following ideas as this bill moves forward. Number one, provide some sort of local compensation grant or reimbursement for the potentially new mandate. Right now, as the bill is formatted, it is an unfunded mandate. For example, let's say that someone was making $120,000 a county salary. If their federal wages while they're overseas are only $80,000, the county who's paying the healthier package would be paying $40,000 in differential pay. Well, one or two cases of this, so total of $40,000 or $80,000, might be seen as a small blip in a $100 million levy. It could still be an impact, especially in the present time where reserves and National Guard are being used more and more as part of our nation's active military strategy, not to mention in a time of war. For smaller rural counties, two cases or more of this could be a significant part of the levy. And again, and I would like to highlight this, right now, this bill would disproportionately impact the counties that are doing the right things by hiring veterans. an aid program could come in the form of full reimbursement via the county program aid mechanism, or could be as creative as something such as a new grant program that would provide county employers with high percentage of veterans in their workplace with a reimbursement, which would further incent counties to hire veterans. The number two thing that I would bring up is just a fair comparison of wages. Right now, as the bill is formed, it compares the county's salary to the military base pay. But as members may be aware, there are also various other compensation packages, whether they be basic housing allowances, basic food allowances, COLA allowances, or others, which could actually increase the amount of the total military compensation package. So a suggestion could be making sure that the benefit packages are equally compared. Again, I want to reiterate that we are not in disagreement with the intent, but do have some suggestions on alternative approaches, and we'll close by thanking Representative Lesh and the committee for allowing me to speak on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hilgard. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 142? Okay. Seeing none, is there member discussion? Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, I appreciate bringing this bill forward. I got a chance to hear this bill in Vets Committee. The testifier just mentioned a little bit about the towards the end of the testimony, the benefit packages being equally compared. And I just wanted to ask why it is. I understand that the bill is just taking base pay versus the pay that they would otherwise get had the individual not been deployed. And I just wanted to point out beyond basic housing allowance, when I was in the military and deployed in Iraq, I know there was imminent danger pay, combat pay, overseas pay, hazardous duty pay, and sometimes per diem. So there's certainly a lot more pay that goes in over and beyond the base pay. And so I was just wondering what the motivation was there not to include those things and only look at the base pay with this program.
Thank Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, we wrote the bill to be commensurate with what other local units of government were offering soldiers, and that was base pay. And so that included City of St. Paul, City of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, any other situation where a person would be in danger of having to take that hit. The BAH and BAH Type 2, which with kids, et cetera, the BAH, Basic Allowance for Housing, is based on zip code, as you know, and so it varies greatly depending on where you live. So if you happen to live you rent an apartment, or you live with your mom, let's say, in what's that rich neighborhood in Minneapolis? Frank Horsey. Linden Hills. Okay. People in Linden Hills, you got a pretty sweet BAH going on, right? But if you live in, like, the low-rent district, like, oh, I don't know, Elk River, like a nickel or something. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry, Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, let's not
make about personalities. Well, that's why I said Elk River, not in Nick Zerwas's neighborhood. But
you've been to my home.
It's a pretty nice home. But that's why, because I didn't want people to be penalized basically. So that's why I wrote it that way. I will offer to you that I dropped this bill in the wake of, the best I can describe is Stonewall by the county. And if there was no stonewalling, I probably would have offered some kind of compromise. And that would have been me. I want Major Famodu to be made whole. But they haven't offered a compromise. All I've gotten is different answers for why they can't fix the situation for this soldier. And that has greatly disappointed me, so that's why. But if there was something that was coming from that side, I think I'd probably be inclined to do that.
Representative Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I remember you talking a little bit about that and the frustration there. You tried to do this in a non-legislative process first, apparently. So just one last question. How many people in the state would you expect would be affected by this program?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Heiner, that's a great question. So the military, as you know, military pay charts are uniform, regardless of what branch you serve in or where you are in the country. Okay, so there is really only one donut hole in the state of Minnesota, if you're talking about municipal employees, of someone who's going to make more in their public sector job than they do in a certain position. And that really is 03s and 04s, so captains and majors, who are employed as county attorneys in either Hennepin or Ramsey County. And Hennepin already offers it. Those are the two highest paid county attorneys in the state based on their pay scales. You know, other county attorneys just don't get paid that much. So when they deploy, they're going to get a pay bump between all the incentives and all that other stuff. But Hennepin and Ramsey counties are to the point where their folks get paid enough because they're high demand job, they're the best people, where they fall in that donut hole of 03s and 04s. Once you make it to 05, you're kind of out of the donut hole once you're a light colonel. And that's why I wrote it this way, because Hennepin has differential pay. Ramsey doesn't. But I would note that Minneapolis and St. Paul City Attorney's Offices both have differential pay offered.
Representative Hyde? Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that Hennepin and Ramsey County attorneys are amongst the highest paid. Can you give the committee an idea of what that number is? I'm guessing that's a public number anyway. But
I think it is.
Nevertheless.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinrich, I think maybe I did know what Major Famodu made at one point. I think it's about high 70s, I think. but that's what I recall. It could be high 70s or low 80s is what I recall, and that's consistent probably with the pay scale. But I don't quote me on that. I think it's bumper.
Representative Heinrich? Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Additional member discussion? Okay. Representative Lesh, any closing remarks?
I just wanted to note that the testimony you heard from Mr. Hilgart and the generous incentive packages that are offered by local units of government for service members, including deployed service members, most of those are state mandated. We pass laws up here to require that they do that. There are instances where local units of government take it on their own initiative to do that. That's why we have the disparity in which local units of a government offer differential pay. But that would be just my last closing comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 142 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Representative Moran, thank you for your patience. House File 1258 is before us. I will move that House File 1258 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I understand you have an amendment that there's no question met all the requirements. That's the DE1. Would you like me to move the amendment to
yes,
put the
please.
Bill in the shape you'd like it? Okay. I will move the H-1258-DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. The bill is in the shape you would like it. Representative Moran, please describe your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the DE1 amendment, what it simply does is just add an expiration date to the bill. So this is a bill about trauma-informed policies and practices that leads to creating resilient trauma-informed societies where all individual families have the opportunity and the support necessary to thrive. This is an approach that advocates for public policies and programs at the state, local, and tribal levels that incorporates up-to-date scientific findings regarding the relationship between trauma across the lifespan of the many social and health problems. In addition, work in collaboration with communities, cities, and tribes to develop trauma-informed and prevention-focused policies and practices that would reflect experiences in the field. A trauma-informed approach realizes the widespread impact of trauma, and it understands potential paths for recovery. It recognizes the signs and symptoms of trauma in clients, families, staff, and others involved in the system. It responds by fully integrating knowledge about trauma into policies, procedures, and practices. Adopting a trauma-informed framework focuses attention on what can be done at the policy level. In the past few years, as this framework has gained traction, there has been an upsurge of interest and actions among both state and federal policymakers. Significantly, these efforts are almost always interagency and cross-sector in design. Equally noteworthy, They build on a public health approach, addressing both the individual and structural concerns and integrating public education, health promotion, treatment, and prevention. This trend reflects an understanding that trauma affects every aspect of life across the lifespan, and that single focus or single agency solutions will not be adequate. The creation of a task force to help us as policymakers make better policy decisions across the spectrum of our committees is not only necessary, but is also cost effective. I hope to have the support of this body in passing House File 1258. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Did you have any?
I do have two testifiers. The first being Jess Anna Glover.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jess Anna Glover, and I'm a mother, an attorney, a neighbor, and a community member. I'm a passionate advocate for youth, and I'm the executive director of Mentor Minnesota. That's the only statewide organization supporting, advocating, and educating around equality to the 200 or more mentoring programs in the state. That's who I am today. But my story prior to the age of 18 was one of abuse, neglect, abandonment, and living in a home with mental illness and substance abuse. In Minnesota, there are 9 questions on our ACEs test, and for each one you can say yes to, you count 1. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, mental illness of a household member, problematic drinking of a household member, drug use by a household member, divorce or separation of a parent, domestic violence toward a parent, incarceration of a household member. I'm a 6. If those ACEs were bricks, imagine the wall that would sit in front of me, blocking you and me. Imagine that pile of bricks being carried around in the backpack of an 8-year-old in 3rd grade. We know that kids experience that level of trauma will have different brain development. They're experiencing fight, flight, or freeze that's dumping cortisol into their systems while their brain is developing. We know from research that it will change health outcomes over their lifetime in dramatic ways. But we also know that creating resiliency can combat the effects of ACEs and other traumas. You can't really teach it. You have to create it. And you create it through relationships between kids and caring adults, for example. That's why our work to create relationships through mentoring is so important. We can change how we address interventions and prevention if we wear the trauma-informed lens. Consider the opioid crisis. The individual using may be abusing drugs in the home, may be incarcerated, may be in treatment, may have mental health needs, or may die as a result of use. Now imagine the kids that are in that home with the individual using. Those are ACEs. Those are ACEs the child is accumulating. So now what? We can wait for 15 years and then turn our heads when they end up in the juvenile justice system. Or we can bring the interventions like mentoring closer in time to when those ACEs are occurring. This is what it looks like to bring trauma-informed lenses to our work. We cannot ignore this. 15% of adults in Minnesota have more than 5 ACEs. In a class of 30 students, 2 or 3 have more than 5 ACEs. Youth in Minnesota correctional facilities are more likely than not to have experienced ACEs. We know kids with high ACE scores become adults with high ACE scores. And we cannot ignore historical trauma that has passed on through generations. It's affecting our communities. I was lucky. I had caring adults in my life. Teachers, coaches, neighbors, church youth group leaders, parents of my friends, and my own mother. They believed in me and helped me to create resiliency. But you shouldn't have to be lucky when we know we can make systemic changes to reduce and prevent ACEs and the effect of trauma. We must do this work through collaboration, leadership, and research. It will take considering the intersections of agency work, this intersection of health, education, public safety, and the justice systems. This bill supports taking what we know and what so many are already working on, and gives a state structure to move this policy work forward. It's timely and it's essential. Thank you, Representative Moran, for your leadership and your persistence on this issue. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to join you today and speak in support of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony.
And the next testifier is Emily Clary.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, so my name is Emily Clary, C-L-A-R-Y. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is really an honor to be here. So I am the director of ACE Collaborative Partnerships at Minnesota Communities Caring for Children, otherwise known as MCCC. And MCCC is a nonprofit organization and a chartered member of Prevent Child Abuse America. And we are a nonprofit organization based in St. Paul, but we have a statewide reach. And our mission is to prevent the incidence of child abuse neglect and neglect in Minnesota with the help of hundreds of our community-based partners and champions across the state. Today, I am here as a representative of MCCC in full support of House File Number 1258, which seeks to create the Task Force on Childhood Trauma-Informed Policies and Practices. Over the past 20 years, scientists have made great gains in their understanding of how stress, especially during childhood, can influence that child's health and well-being over the rest of their life. Neurobiologists have learned that child's brains adapt to their environment during development, and toxic stress in childhood can actually change the architecture of the developing brain, and that's in part due to that cortisol being released. Epigeneticists have learned that responses to stress are so powerful that they can be passed down for multiple generations, and that negative experiences may harm how the cells of future generations function, even if that child did not experience that trauma. This has profound implications for communities that have experienced historical trauma. And epidemiologists and public health officials have, researchers have learned that adverse childhood experiences, otherwise known as ACEs, increase the risk for negative health, mental health, and social outcomes, such as experiencing disability, disease, workplace issues, incarceration, and early death, among many others. These researchers also have discovered that the more adversities the child experiences, the greater the risk that that child will have these negative life outcomes. So many health and social problems are linked to ACEs that some scientists have declared them a public health crisis. A 2011 study of Minnesotans revealed that most adults have at least one ACE, and a 2016 survey of the Minnesota Student Survey data of over 100,000 students in our schools in Minnesota indicated that at least 35 students in 8th, 9th, and 11th grade have at least one ACE. It's pretty clear that ACEs are common in Minnesota. And if we look at that student data a little bit more, compared to students with zero ACEs, those with four or more ACEs in Minnesota are five times more likely to report past month alcohol use, 12 times more likely to report prescription drug misuse, and 23 times more likely to report past year suicidal attempts. Finally, I want to turn to the last body of research that I want to touch on today, and that is the resilience research. Resilience researchers carry a message of hope. They have discovered that there are concrete ways that individuals, families, organizations, and communities can buffer the harmful effects of childhood adversity through trauma-informed policies and practices. This shows us that ACEs are not destiny. With our efforts to reduce the impact of ACEs comes the potential to dramatically reduce the costs associated with ACEs-related problems. And many states have taken the lead to adopt trauma-informed policies and practices to reduce the harm of ACEs and promote resiliency. Many communities in Minnesota are currently working to address ACEs and build resiliency at the local level, since there is too much at stake if we maintain the status quo. MCCC, in partnership with the Department of Human Services, is currently working to educate communities around the state about the long-term effects of ACEs and has been spreading the message of hope that resilience research brings. MCCC is currently partnering with local champions working to address ACEs in five tribes and over 50 communities across the state. We believe that the proposed task force has the tremendous potential to help guide trauma-informed changes within the systems that support children and families in Minnesota, and can provide much-needed support to communities across the state that have already been actively engaged in creating trauma-informed local efforts. It is imperative that Minnesota take the lead to adapt its way of doing business in light of this emerging research, The health and well-being of our future generations is at stake if we do not act now. The development of this trauma-informed task force is a crucial step towards a healthier Minnesota. I so thank you for your attention and time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1258? Seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the 2.1, you've got two ombudspersons from the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, and I'm curious, is it four or five total ombudspersons in that group?
Representative Moran.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe there are at least four.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would have thought, because knowing the groups that select those ombudspersons, that you might look at those communities and what is their average ACEs score, and then selecting the two ombudspersons which have communities that are have the highest scores. I would think that criteria might be somewhat useful for the committee members. Each of the ombudspersons are selected by a it's a little bit late and I've got a cold, but basically it's like the Latino Council and each of the similar councils will select someone, and they're specialized for those communities. And so that's why I would think that when you do this, I know it's being a little bit more prescriptive, but basically that might be the best too, because they'll have more background and they can also take what they learn in the task force back to their activity as being an ombudsperson for those communities.
Is there such a thing as community-specific ACE average scores or anything along those lines? Well, I guess I don't know if that's even possible to do, to take that into account.
Right.
Representative Moran?
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I think if you looked within all communities, you would find some ACEs. I think there will probably be some researchers that may say, well, as we look at historical trauma, as we look at ACEs, which is average childhood experiences, that you may find those numbers higher in, like, maybe the African American community and the Native American community. But again, in the language said the Commission of Human Services would establish and appoint. And you may take those things into consideration.
President Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having, over the years, I've heard the different councils presenting, percent of incarceration, families, I know that almost all the ACEs that were mentioned by the testifiers, actually they're specific data by for each of the groups, so it's available there. I'm just thinking, because not only do they bring to the task force, but when they return back, especially because they're involved with families and children, they may gain a greater perspective, and they bring value back from there. And it's just a suggestion, maybe to look at that to, improve the composition and the effectiveness. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Selk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know for sure. I don't want to make this long, but every time I go to see the doctor, they ask me a series, I think, of about 8 questions, and they're used to evaluate my life. Mm-hmm. There are days when, I answer differently than other days. And I suspect that in that, they are also then having an accumulated kind of thing. And so I see in this a way of understanding probably children over a span of time as they would go through that kind of common health visit kind of scenario. And I'm just curious, are we at the time when that might start happening, or is this system in a place where we're here first? I get that this is not at the next level. I'm already thinking down the road, for use of data and then maybe application of changes and those kinds of things. So is there some of that also forward after this bill, the creation of this task force?
So,
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so you heard a lot about us talking about children, but children become teens, and teens become adults, right? And they also are impacted by ACEs, right? And so what we do know is that we, as we look at legislatively, how we look at solutions and policies and practices, because we can look and say, like, right now, we pour like millions of dollars into systems, but the results are not better, right? We pour millions of dollars, and we say we still have some of those disparities right here in the state of Minnesota. And so what a task force can help us to do is, one, learn about trauma-informed policies and practices and what that looks like as we as legislators begin to look at how we're going to operate within our different committees, because often we live in our silos, you know, government op, you know, the work that you do here, you know, impacts someone's life in Health and Human Service or in corrections and juvenile detention. They're all interconnected. And so the hope is that this task force will help create some language, some policies that we as legislators can use as policymakers to better inform how we can spend our money, right? But also how we can also have policies that are working in the best interest of children, families, and communities across the state.
Yeah. Anything you want to add?
I know I opened a huge door, and it's like people could write their doctoral theses on my question. So I'm just looking for responses, particularly from the people that are already looking at data-driven. I could hear that in both of your testimonies, and I was wondering how far is that data collection into usefulness? And I understand this is that's outside of necessarily this specific effort, but it also, I think, can grow to being connected also.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is representative. There is data. This is like evidence-based practices that has been used around the country. I don't know if you guys have this little document here that says California looks to lead the nation in unraveling childhood trauma. But I came across this document. You may not have it.
Yeah.
But I came across this document. And we talk about what is trauma-informed policy. What is that? What do that look like, right? And I'm just going to just end, like, the end of this document. You say in the big picture, these experts say addressing the fallout of traumatic stress will require a broader paradigm shift to a system that recognizes that bad behavior can be a physical symptom rather than a moral failing, right? So the governor in California said that Governor Newsom has signaled a move in that direction. In January, he said he would transfer the Division of Juvenile Justice out of the Department of Corrections, which runs the state prison system, and into the Health and Human Service Agency. That's a paradigm shift about how we look at behavior and how people show up and find themselves in corrections, right? And so it's reimagining. It's looking at things through a different lens. But I think at the end of the day, what we want is we want people to be self-sufficient. We want people capable of taking care of themselves and their family and not dependent on the state, because we cannot spin our way out of whatever solutions we're trying to do here. And so it is really a paradigm shift about how we do that, what it looks like based on evidence, based on brain development. This is like science.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Okay, any additional questions? Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I want to thank Representative Moran for this bill, and especially just for the way that, in my short time here, that I've seen you leading on this issue in particular, and your advocacy for embedding trauma-informed practices in all of the work that we do. Because to your point, it's like if we want healthy families, healthy kids, healthy communities, then this is actually like a really exciting framework that seems like it can help us get there. And so, yeah, I'm just really grateful for this and for all of the work that you're doing on this in HHS. And I feel like you're doing it in education and you're doing it, you know, all over the state enterprise. And it's so necessary. So thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just want to say that this bill, this here was in the omnibus bill that got vetoed. It is a bipartisan bill. I just want to thank, you know, Representative Albright and Kreisha for signing on to this bill. It moved in both bodies last session.
Yep. Thank you, Rosa Moran. Any additional member discussion? If you're seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1258, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative
Moran. Thank you.
Representative Lilly, I understand you will be presenting House File 1955. I will move that House File 1955... Oh, 2434. I apologize. Okay. Finance or policy? Okay. I think it's finance, so that the correct motion would be to refer to Ways and Means. Okay, so I will move that House File 2434 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you for being here, Representative Lilly, into this late hour. If you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Department of Public Safety's policy bill for this session that they're trying to work on some language changes that need to be done to improve the way things are right now. I don't know what you want me exactly to go through, but with me I have Ms. Knutson from the department, and she could kind of go through the bill and just kind of explain what some of the changes are. So if that's sure. Okay with the chair.
Yeah, that would be just fine. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Katie Knutson, the Legislative Director for the Department of Public Safety. The part of the bill that is in front of the committee this evening is Article 2, where we make changes to the Statewide Emergency Communication Board. We do have an amendment, the A19, that we would want to offer. And then I have Dana Wahlberg, the director of the Emergency Communication Network, here to explain why we're making these changes.
Sure. I will move the A19-0180 amendment. We do have it in our packet. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you'd like it. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lilly and members of the committee. My name is Dana Wahlberg. I'm the director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division of the Department of Public Safety. And we operate under the 403 statute for most of our daily course of business. We have some changes that we would like to make that are based upon changes in the way that we have been conducting business over the years. There's three primary areas that we are requesting changes. One is basically a global change from the governance structure. The name of the board that used to govern us was the Statewide Radio Board, and that was conceived back in the day when the land mobile radio system was deployed, and the statewide trunked radio system became into being in the state of Minnesota. So the board was constructed to guide that project and to advise our division on how to move forward with that. That radio system has since been about 98% deployed, and the governance model that we used for that was so successful and worked so well that now, as our division has increased from managing 911 and land mobile radio to also including wireless broadband and integrated public alert and warning, we would like to continue with the governance model, but rather than name it as the statewide radio board, we intend to upgrade that to the statewide emergency communications board to actually reflect that it is encompassing of all four of the program areas that we are responsible within our division. That actually went to a vote of the statewide radio board back in 2013, and it was approved. So in essence, we have been operating under that model since, but we just have not had a statutory change. So in addition to that name change, in 2017, the board approved by a unanimous vote to add two additional members to the board. We felt that there were underserved portions of the public safety and community in the state of Minnesota that were not represented effectively, so we've requested to add a seat for the Commissioner of Corrections and as well as a representative from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. So that's the second change. The third change is really came about at the end of 2018 when Sherburne County became the 10th county to be part of the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board. Previously, there were nine counties, so we'd like to change that, update the language to reflect the 10-county metropolitan area with the addition of Sherburne County. And finally, there is some contradictory language in reference to how the chiefs of police, the fire chiefs, and the emergency medical service providers are appointed. There's language that indicates that they a recommendation can be made from each one of those appointing authorities, and that it would then be appointed by the governor using the open appointment process. But further down in the legislation under Section 3 of Section 403.36, it specifies that the board is not subject to the open appointment process. So we did work with the Secretary of State's office to confirm that we were not subject to that open appointment process. So just to provide clarification and remove that contradiction within the statute, we'd like to have that language stricken to mitigate the conflict. And with that, I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wahlberg. Are there any member questions? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Lilly?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's essentially is a cleanup bill. My apologies that I don't know the bill as well as I should. I'm a little bit late to the game on this.
We were just about to pass the bill out, Representative.
I know, so you didn't. luckily, we have star staff. I wanted to apologize to Representative Zerwas. It is going to be. We have a couple weeks of Senate time to get the bill heard and moving over there. So it is. Thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go through the language line by line.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, we could quickly turn this into like the broadcast news. I could.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2434, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Transportation, finance. Oh, Ways and Means. It's got to go to Ways and Means.
It just goes to transportation policy. It doesn't have to go through Ways and Means.
I will take your word for it. If it's just a policy bill, it can go directly to the... Okay, I will withdraw my motion that it be recommended, re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee, and I will make a different motion that it be referred to the Transportation Policy Committee as amended. Okay. Yes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yes, thank you. Representative Elkins. So we have House File 511. I will move that House File 511 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Hey, would you like to describe your bill, Representative Elkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'm cognizant that I'm the only thing standing in the way of us going home, so I'll try and keep this brief.
Sure.
This basically undoes a bill passed about
just
a year.
Second, if we could keep the background noise down a little bit. We do still have one more bill. Thank you. Continue, Representative Elkins.
This bill would once again enable local governments to enact bans of plastic bags at the municipal level. What I would say in favor of this is that we had an extensive hearing on this in local government where we were actually able to use video as well, but imagine, if you will, the PBS video of plastic bags going through a recycling machine where some local governments, through their recycling operations, are incurring millions of dollars a year in costs every year just from the plastic bags gumming up the works. People think they're plastic. They can just go into the recycling bin, and they can't. You either have to go into a special plastic bag recycling bin at a local retailer if there's one there. But most people just put them in the recycling bin with the other plastics, and they go to the recycling bin facility. The machines can't handle them. They literally clog the machines, requiring hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of maintenance. And if even a few of them get into the finished recycling bins of material, the bins of they usually end up with the paper. If there are more than a couple of paper plastic bags in a bin of paper, the entire bin or the entire bale is adulterated and unsellable to the point where the Chinese will no longer accept our recycled paper because it is so frequently adulterated. But the rationale for allowing cities to once again do this is that recycling rules do vary by city depending on the capabilities of the local recycler serving the city. So the idea that they need to be uniform everywhere is kind of a myth, because if you want to know what goes in your recycling bin in your city, you have to check with your city anyway. So this gives cities an opportunity to chip away at this problem at the local level working with their own recycler.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We did hear testimony on this in the local government subcommittee, but given the fact that everyone here has waited so patiently, if somebody would like to speak, I do want to afford that opportunity. I guess I would ask you, just since we have heard testimony on this in the subcommittee, just to keep your remarks maybe to 2 minutes on this one, but particularly given the late hour. But given the fact that you've waited, I do want to at least give you that opportunity. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Irene Gao. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And as many of you know, the League of Minnesota Cities represents 833 of 853 cities around the state. And I will keep my testimony short. We support House File 511 because the League's long-held core value that local elected decision makers are in the best position to determine what health, safety, and welfare regulations best serve their constituents. Ordinances at the local level are enacted only after a comprehensive legal and open process. Local governments are required to publish notices about meetings where policies will be discussed and decisions will be made. Under the state's open meeting law, these discussions and decisions must occur in meetings that are accessible to the members of the public. Unlike state legislative leaders, local elected officials are held accountable through the Minnesota's robust elections process. Preservation of local control in Minnesota has yielded statewide benefits. Cities are often laboratories for determining public policy approaches to the challenges that face residents and businesses. Please allow city officials to continue doing this good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Gao. I do actually have a list, too. Jamie Fool? Okay. I hope I pronounced that right.
Like swimming pool, but cool. Close. The letters don't help any.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. Chair Freiberg, members of the committee, good evening. I'm Jamie Poole, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today on House File 511. Minnesota has a unique culture of hundreds of homegrown grocers, convenience stores, many of whom are independent, multi-generational, locally owned. We are, the MGA is their state trade association. We have over 300 members with nearly 1,200 locations statewide, as well as wholesale and manufacturer partners. Social and environmental responsibility is a priority for our members. In just about every local grocery store, right on your way in or out of the store, is a convenient plastic recycling drop spot. Through this voluntary effort, millions of pounds of plastics are recycled annually with tremendous success. These recycled products are not just bags from our stores, but they're plastics used within your home. And I just have a sample just to show you. This is from one of our grocers. We've got dry cleaner bags as well as the bags you take out, as well as things that are packaged in there. So all of this is being taken back at the stores. For years, we've encouraged our shoppers to reduce, reuse, and recycle by offering choice at checkout, believing our customers have the capacity to know what's best for their household. Many Minnesotans opt for that plastic bag at checkout and use them for multiple purposes. As a matter of fact, one city council member shared with us in an email, "I use these bags as a recycle for dog poop. So you are right, I'll shop right over the border if I need to." We received this email from a customer. "In short, I have a nerve problem in my arms and cannot drive a car. I need to use the bus. I need to transport my groceries on the bus and over the course of a few blocks each way walking. Plastic bags are my best choice. I should be able to make the choice that best suits my needs." Execution at checkout presents many layers, such as additional costs for implementation, a slower checkout, the EBT, SNAP, and WIC transactions, which we execute uniformly all across the state, and a taxation complications, all of which will change our customer shopping experience. Our marketplace is changing dramatically, and that's real. What we must be allowed to meet our customers' expectations. Providing plastic, paper, and reusable bags at checkout is an expectation. As the cornerstone of each and every Main Street, we don't have the option to pick up and leave our communities. Frustrating our customers who are already experimenting with online options for their needs doesn't make sense. Good. Forcing our cashiers to play bag police doesn't make sense. A patchwork of city-by-city ordinances doesn't make sense. As a state, we can lead the way. Reducing litter needs a commitment from those who litter. And we support collaborative, voluntary, educational opportunities that drive success. And I'll be happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Poole. I have Tony Quillis on the list.
Mr. Chairman, I will also be brief, taking your direction, knowing it's a long day and it's been a long week. I do wish that Representative Elkins had been able to show his video, though, because it did talk about a great company called Trex Deck that makes decking and lawn furniture, and it was on a beach with way out here washing up, and we both wish we could have been there at the time, Mr. Chairman. But again, I'm Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just wanted to point out that Minnesota proudly leads the nation in recycling rates, and publicly and privately, we've invested millions of dollars in waste recycling programs and infrastructure in this state. One of those programs was called It's in the Bag, that was started by the Chamber of Commerce, and a lot of plastic bags and film recycling programs provided to customers the opportunity to recycle the bags at recycling at retail locations. We recycled over 5.5 million pounds between 2003 and 2009, and that program is now located over at the Recycling Association of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to point out the Minnesota WasteWise, whose program motto is Less Waste is Smart Business, that's located, it's an affiliate of the Chamber, and we work with counties as well as businesses to lower their recycling and sustainability rates. Mr. Chairman, one final point. When we talk about the patchwork that Ms. Poole has talked about to go through our manufacturers of these products, it's really confusing for them and where they can sell the product and where they can't, whether they can sell it in Edina but not in Thief River Falls. They can sell it in Winona but not in Minneapolis. So I just wanted to make that point, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time. I know it's been a late night.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Quillis. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House File 511? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderetti for Metro Cities, which represents the collective interests of cities across the seven-county metropolitan region. Metro Cities thanks Representative Elkins for carrying this bill, and while our association does not have a position on banning bags, we strongly support a city's authority to have a public process to determine its own policy. This bill restores local decision-making authority in this area, and we urge the committee to support House File 511. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony as well as your brevity. Welcome to the committee. Please just come forward. Thank you for waiting through this long night. And please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, I'm Kim Erickson. And I came here because I was here last week when they all were speaking. I was so offended and outraged by Minnesota Grocery and Minnesota Realty. Anyway, so I'm Kim Erickson. I live in St. Louis Park, and I represent Zero Waste West Metro. I feel like Americans are very patriotic, and we trust our government to do what's right to keep us safe. We already know for a fact that plastic bags are dangerous for our planet, but the general public feels all right using them as a constant because they feel like it's free, so it must not be that bad, right? We used to think smoking was safe in public spaces, but soon we discovered it was not the case and made legal changes accordingly. Single-use plastic bans are springing up quickly around the world. Kenya, the European Union, Australia, and many individual cities. Our own capital, Washington, D.C., passed a law to have a 5-cent tax on plastic bags, and with that tax, they found 85% reduction in plastic bag. It should be noted that that 5-cent tax is used for river cleanup projects and providing reusable bags to low-income families and elderly communities. The city of San Francisco was the first city in the U.S. to completely ban plastic bags and place a 10-cent fee on paper and compostable bags. They have seen a 72% reduction on plastic bag pollution. After Seattle banned and had placed a tax on bags, they saw a 78% reduction. Kenya has gone as far as banning plastic bags, and if you are caught with a plastic bag or selling them, you can spend 4 years in jail. The Chinese, I'm not promoting for that, I'm just saying, you know, Chinese companies can be fined $1,500 if they produce plastic bags. Minnesota is getting left behind in this. Let's not embarrass ourselves. Our children are watching, guys. This Friday, they're going to be walking out for climate change. These are our future voters that are coming up. Well, I'd love to say businesses will take upon themselves to make the change, but in reality, they do not make decisions based on the environment. I support this plastic bag ban. I support tax on disposable bags. Let's be part of the solution, not part of the problem. It's 2019. Why are we still talking about this? This is not a new idea, folks. I feel very strongly about this. In fact, so strongly that I was in the Dominican Republic today, and I called out of work to come here to fly to Minnesota to speak to you guys. I think we talked about too much about this. Let's start doing something with actions. Thank you.
Thank you for being here, Ms. Erickson. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ashley Kennedy, and I also represent Zero Waste West Metro. I live in Chanhazen with my husband and four kids. I asked my neighbor, Steve Syverson, if I could speak about him. He takes a four-mile walk every day, and on that walk, he collects garbage. And every day, he collects 3 plastic trash bags full of other plastic trash bags. So he thinks that most of them are falling out of the back of garbage trucks, which means that they're not getting recycled. And Chanhazen would look much different without Steve. And as you know, to downcycle a plastic bag, it must be brought to a drop-off location. Most bags are thrown away, and even worse, put in the curbside recycling, as mentioned earlier. The current recycling sorting plants must turn off the equipment multiple times a day to tear out the tangled bags. It's kind of like yarn getting stuck in a vacuum. And I also want to remind you that Minnesota contains 92,000 miles of streams and rivers, which all ultimately go to the ocean. We already know how damaging these bags are to our environment and personal health. I want Minnesota to be a part of the solution, not the problem, and Minnesota needs to be a better neighbor. I also, which was from earlier, take offense when the intelligence of Minnesota residents is questioned, and it's implied that a change would be too confusing for the consumers. If my 85-year-old grandmother in Southern California was able to understand the changes in plastic bags in her area, I think we can too. And if all Costco shoppers, without issue, understand that they don't have bags available, it can be done elsewhere. Let's let individual cities have the ability to make the decision to ban or charge for disposable bags. I'm honestly confused how this happened in the first place. This is a bit ridiculous. Yeah. There have been some pretty heavy issues talked about today, and a plastic bag doesn't seem like a big deal in comparison, but it really is. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kennedy. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House File 511? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins. Certainly some passionate testimony today, and there's been lots of different issues covered, but this is the first one where I've heard things like ridiculous and offended. And just want to maybe point out a few things that I'd like the members to consider. It's my understanding, actually, and I don't know if you know this, Representative Elkins, but paper in landfills actually takes about the same amount of time to break down as the plastic does. And to my understanding, it's it takes up 9 times more room than plastic does in landfills. So it might not be as green as people think. I understand the intent here, again, and I appreciate that. Also, I just want to point out there's a chemistry professor named David Tyler at the University of Oregon. He writes in depth about how plastic bags are actually represent about half of the carbon footprint that paper or cotton do. So I just think that maybe this would be to just kind of tap the brakes a little bit on this and find out a little bit more about what exactly what the environmental impact is. I understand that's a real concern, and it is for me as well. It sure would be a shame to make a move where we think we're doing something that's great for the environment, and in fact, it can have some unintended consequences. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the time to just make a comment there. Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Sure. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins. When we saw this bill a couple years ago, what we did learn is that one of the reasons that we started using plastic bags was because retailers were trying to recoup some costs, because there's so much regulation, so many taxes, so much this, so much that they needed a way to find out how to do business a little bit cheaper so that they could actually keep costs down. We look at that again now. I mean, they're doing a great job with having a lot of recycling areas. When I walk in, I have bags that I bring in all the time. We recycle all our bags and take them in. It's not that hard to do. And I think if there's a lot of people not doing it, then education has to be a bigger piece of what we're telling people to do. We need to tell them more about the recycling opportunities, what the bags can go for. I mean, if you can get lawn furniture, I'm all for that, sitting on the beach, on a chair made from plastic bags. But I think we also have to look at the fiscal responsibilities we have as well, to make sure that we keep our companies, our stores, our malls. They're closing like crazy. I don't know if you've been paying attention lately, but just in my community in St. Cloud, we've had more closing than opening for quite a while, and it's getting really scary. So this is a way to keep the cost down for a lot of our retailers. And I think it's up to the public to also be cognizant of that. If you want your retailers to carry more whatever type of bag, whether it be paper or bring your own, it's also up to the consumer to be aware of what they're doing. So thank you, I think, maybe, for bringing this forward. But I will vote no, because I look at maybe they are unintended consequences. It's the cost that a lot of our retailers are facing, and
they're not doing really great right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cagle? I'm sorry, you had been first, and then I started writing in another place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think when we talk about costs, we have to realize that there's more than just money when we talk about costs. There's cost to the environment. There's cost to, I was watching this documentary, and they found a turtle that its entire gut was filled with plastic bags. So I think we have to think a little bit more globally when we're talking about cost. But one of the things that whenever I hear when this discussion about plastic bags comes up, I think about this. One of my good friends in college, there was a tree outside their house in Duluth. And when I first started college, there was a plastic bag that was stuck up in that tree. I lived in Duluth for almost 8 years. It didn't take me that long to finish college, but but I remember that when I graduated and moved away, that stupid plastic bag was still up in the tree. And so every time I hear, this debate, I think about that plastic bag. So in honor of that plastic bag stuck up in the tree on 2nd Street in Duluth, I'm voting yes on this bill.
And just so we're clear, too, this bill does not ban plastic bags. This bill would just repeal a recently adopted preemption provision to allow local governments the authority to regulate them. So Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of made my point. I was, I obviously live in Minneapolis. Afu's not here, but I think we're the only two. Oh. I know they're always like confusing to other people, but not usually you.
That's true.
Yeah. So, obviously this piece of legislation was passed because the Minneapolis City in response to the Minneapolis City Council. Adopting a user fee on plastic bags. And so I guess Representative Elkins discussed the issues around that plastic bags present in the processing of solid waste. That is a function that municipal governments are in charge of. This feels really heavy-handed, and it's interesting that having worked in municipal government and now being here, it's like, municipal government is the level of government that's closest to the residents of a certain area in a lot of ways, deals with the most local issues, and the, treatment of solid waste is specifically delegated to them. I'm supportive of this effort and allowing, that level of government that's closest to the people to make decisions that are right for our communities. I don't remember who brought up Costco, but it's the same way at Aldi, too. Like, they just have the boxes, and you put your groceries in the boxes. It's not a big deal. Also, a grocery store that's close to me, voluntarily instituted the policy that was preempted that we passed in Minneapolis, and it's like you pay an extra 5 cents for a bag. It's not a big deal. They just got rid of plastic. You have paper bags, and you pay 5 cents for it. I mean, it does. My perception is that it doesn't have much of an impact on the grocer's bottom line because the person just pays for it, and it reminds you, maybe to bring back your bags like Representative Tice does. So I'll try to be better, and maybe the 5 cent fee helps me a little bit. And it took me 10 years to graduate college. But thank you.
Fair enough.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I look at the provision that was passed in 2017 a little bit differently, of course. The provision that we passed in 2017 was bipartisan. It was signed into law by Governor Dayton. And so I think the idea that that this is somehow one party that pushed this forward, it was in response to what seemed like a significant overreach in local government, which, you and I both have experience on local city councils, and I generally defer to local control and local governments, but I think in the metro area specifically, when we start to see different cities adopting different ordinances of these types that directly impact consumers and product availability, it becomes a bit more challenging. Because I would oppose the Elkins bill at this time, and I'd request a roll call on this one, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins. A couple points, and I'll try to make them quickly. So almost 20 years ago, I remember taking a trip to Sweden with my betrothed. And while I was there, we went to the grocery store on a number of occasions. In fact, we went to all kinds of stores. And one of the things that I noticed is that everywhere they went, they had reusable bags. They had these really nifty ones that actually went down to about so big, you could clip them onto your purse, you could clip them anywhere, quite frankly, and in fact, they were actually sturdier than the plastic bags. And I guess I thought, wow, that's really intriguing. Why don't we have this here in the States? I can't imagine why not. And to that point, I will tell you that anytime I go to the grocery store, even if I buy only one thing, they insist on putting it in a plastic bag, whether I ask them to or not. I have never had anyone ask me if I wanted a bag, which I do not. And in fact, when I go to Walmart, if I have five items, they give me five plastic bags. And I have never seen a more incredible sense of waste in my life. Now, when we talk about things like cost, if we're really worried about the bottom line of our businesses, here's a really great idea. How about we don't use plastic bags at all? Wouldn't that save them money? Wouldn't that help their bottom line? Seems like it would. If we set an expectation that people are either using reusable bags, which most places have available, if you forgot yours, if you don't have one, it's there. I think it's reasonable to do that, and if that works for cities, I don't see why not. In addition, we talked about costs, and we talked about things like Costco, where they don't even use bags. And for grocers who are trying to save money, if we don't have to break down, we don't have to pay an employee to break down boxes in the back room for an hour because somebody actually loaded their groceries in a box and brought it home and recycled it themselves, that saves money. And that helps the bottom line. So I think there's many reasons why this is really, in my estimation, to some degree, a silly argument that we're here going back and forth. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think what this really boils down to is cities should be able to have the right to decide what's best for their citizens and what makes sense to them. And so us dictating whether or not they can or cannot ban plastic bags is ridiculous. And I think most people are smart enough to find a way to figure out how to carry their groceries if they don't have a plastic bag. And as for the folks who use them for poop bags, well, congratulations, but I think they can figure out how to do that, too. That's all I have. I support the bill.
Any additional member discussion? I'll just point out, you know, since it was mentioned, you know, this was maybe the original bill had bipartisan support. I don't remember the exact sequence of events. I know, Representative Elkins, you weren't here at that point, but I believe Governor Dayton stated he was not supportive of it when it was traveling as an individual bill, and it was ultimately included in one of the budget bills that I think he stated he felt obligated to sign so that the government didn't shut down. So it was one of those policy provisions that was kind of unrelated to the bill and kind of tacked on in there. So it did end up becoming law. I don't think it was enthusiastically supported by both parties or anything along those lines, but that was something that tended to happen in the previous session. So I guess I kind of did the chair thing and editorialized at the end, which is, yes. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you were inferring that the plastic bag portion of the bigger bill was poop encased in a larger container?
I should also mention, I wasn't exactly, but you brought up an interesting point, Representative Quam. So, you know, I don't know why the topic of poop bags keeps coming up, and I keep having to use the word poop in committees, and now I'm doing it as a chair. But I'm not aware of, you know, generally speaking, poop bags, I don't have a dog, but from what I understand, they are sold. They come in a box with about 50 poop bags in them, and I don't know of any local ordinance that ever passed that prohibited those poop bags from being sold. You maybe couldn't get your box of poop bags in a plastic bag. yes. So, but I just want to say I'm not aware of any that any ordinance that was ever under consideration would have banned the use of poop bags. So I don't think that's the case. And on that note, Representative Elkins, would you like to close out this evening?
I have nothing to add, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I will renew my motion that House File 511 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. A roll call has been requested, so the clerk will take the roll. You can take a minute to calm yourself if you want. I could take a roll, too, if you want.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
Yes.
Representative Cagle. Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Pulaski. Representative Sauk.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Lehman. Representative Nash. Representative Quam.
Nay.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
There being 9 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. Representative Elkins, your bill is on its way. we will be meeting tomorrow at our usual time in the basement hearing room, 9:45 on Thursday. This meeting is adjourned.